Detroit. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Boy, what a change in musical styles. Green Day sounding a lot like early Clash, right
awesome.
Into John Lennon.
Hey, why not? Yeah. We like to mix it up around here.
How you doing, Julene?
Doing great. Thanks, Peter. And you?
Were you watching the Grammys at all?
I don't watch television.
Yeah, I guess you've been saying that almost every week. I started, you know what? I think I started
December
every show.
December 17th.
Wow.
It's the last time I watched, except for the Puppy Bowl.
And remember, I never used to watch television. Then we got that big old honking flat screen.
You got the system going.
We just got a Blu-ray DVD player.
Someone actually wrote me an email the other day and said, it's so weird. You and Peter are totally switching personalities.
And the Foo Fighters did an incredible version of I Never Want to Die. Bruce Springsteen.
The Foo Fighters won a Grammy.
Four Grammys
tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everybody, of course, just so sad about the passing of Whitney Houston.
Terrible.
And a lot of people made, of course.
Found her underwater in a bathtub in her hotel room.
Oh, really?
Like she had drowned. Speculation is there were pill bottles around. And
she's had
like that.
Problems.
Her people were out in the other room. Her couple of bodyguards, her hair person, her personal assistant, they were all out there. And they said, you know, she's been in there a little too long when they went in and found her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. Oftentimes creative people are troubled. Not always.
Yeah.
Frequently.
Yeah,
kind of goes with the territory.
It
somehow.
Does.
Like
I know.
You.
Yeah, I know. Kind of. At least, fortunately, I've held it together pretty well these years.
In order to do things good, you have to be at least a little obsessional, right?
Oh, crazy.
Well, I mean obsessional. The amount of time you have to practice your craft.
Yeah, for sure.
You are definitely not obsessional.
Well, you know, I have natural talent, Peter.
You do. You do have natural talent. In fact, Julene Jordan is a terrific singer-songwriter. I know this may be talking out of school. I'm not going to say when or where, but we may be hearing her sing in a public appearance.
At a venue near you soon.
So this is for sure, or maybe?
I'm writing again. Well, I'm going to get up and maybe do some harmonies with our friend David Rovix.
Okay, well, you can announce
Late
it.
Late day at AJ's Cafe. And
in
AJ's
Ferndale.
Cafe in Ferndale is closing down toward the end of March. Sadly, horrible. AJ, if you're listening, we're going to miss you, but we still have a month and a half to get down at AJ's, and he has a big announcement. He's running for office.
Yeah.
And David Rovix, singer-songwriter, who Pete Seeger says, listen to David Rovix. Pete Seeger sent him a check for $100 and said, send me everything you have.
Really? Pete Seeger, of course, no relation to Bob, influenced.
Extra E.
A compatriot of Woody Guthrie, the father of Arlo Guthrie, and Woody Guthrie influenced Bob Dylan.
Pete Seeger's still with us.
Yeah, 90-something, and an incredible endorsement.
Yeah, incredible endorsement. So you want to come out and see David Leap Day, which is Wednesday, February 29th, AJ's Cafe, 9 Mile in Ferndale. Showtime, 7 p.m. And I remember when I called Pete Seeger. I haven't told this story for a while, but I called him to set up an interview for you.
Oh, yeah, right.
Years ago. And he lives in the country. With
New
his
York
wife.
State, up by on the Hudson.
Yeah, yeah. And his wife said, oh, hold on just a minute. And I'm not kidding you. I was on hold for 20 minutes. She had to go back to the back 40 and get Pete. She got him, though.
Yeah.
And he came in, and I would have waited hours to talk to that guy.
So he began singing, I think, about 1940 or something like that. And his voice is certainly deteriorated with age. And he said to me, first off, he said, I do these 25-minute interviews, two of which are going to play at 1 a.m. Eastern tonight. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't know if I'm getting to be an old man. I don't know if I can do 25 minutes, and please don't ask me to sing.
Oh.
Well, I finally had to cut it off at 30 minutes.
See?
And, which is way over the allotted time. You know, this is radio. You're not supposed to go 5 minutes over anything. And plus he sang, although.
Did he really? Yeah. I don't remember that. I mean, I remember the interview, but it's been a little while.
Yeah. All right. This is amazing. People are calling and you don't even know what we're going to talk about. Well,
that's
know what?
Okay.
You can call in and talk about anything you want.
Yes.
Right. And you can call 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
We are really cranking on Facebook, thanks to Jolene and to Debbie, who lives in Northampton, Massachusetts. In the age of the Internet, you have friends all over the world.
Yeah, I'm a personal assistant to David Rovics, and he is...
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon, and lives all over the world, yeah. Pretty much, yeah. On tour. Grammys, I think that my buddy Bailey watched them. I asked him to watch for some political content. We may be hearing from Bailey Boudreau at
our
some
culture
point.
Vulture editor.
Yeah.
Correspondent.
He's on a roll. We've had him on a couple times, and I just said, you know what? Watching the Grammys, because I don't watch TV.
If you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short ones if you'd even like to get them read. If you like, just want to communicate, you make them as long as you want, but no way in the world can we read them on the air. Facebook is facebook.com/nightcall, and likes wanted.
Come on along.
Get in on the fun. We'll have a podcast of this show available at noon tomorrow, noon Monday, thanks to Athena and Sarah, who will be taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Okay, fun's over.
It is.
We got to get, serious now. You know, the right wing is costing me a fortune.
It is?
Yes.
Well, do tell.
Yeah, because every time they commit some outrage, some attack on people, some horrendous statement about people in our country, our community, I go, okay, I'm sending some money, too.
Oh, so, different organizations, yeah, so social like, causes.
Because this Catholic Church deal with this rejecting the White House's new plan on contraception, I said, okay, I'm going to send $50 to the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Okay.
And then also, you know, this Susan B. Komen. Susan G. Komen group was attacking Planned Parenthood. So
trying to take money away from them.
So my wife said, you know, we got to send them some money. Planned Parenthood.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that woman, the Republican who took over Susan G. Komen, Karen Handel, resigned on Tuesday as senior vice president for policy. And I'm damn glad about it.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Adios, MF. Let the door hit you in the butt.
Thank you. You are not pro-woman. You have no right to be in a woman-centric, you know, healthcare-oriented organization when you don't care about women's bodies deep down.
She, Karen Handel, was a former Republican candidate for governor in Georgia. She joined the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation last year. And as you said, she resigned. And she opposes abortion and called for eliminating government money to Planned Parenthood during her 2010 campaign. And then so she loses, right? Lost the primary. And so then she figures, well, how can I do more
change.
Damage?
How can I take women's rights to govern their own bodies away further?
And Planned Parenthood, as has been said innumerable times, that abortions are 3% of what they do. The reason that the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation gives money to Planned Parenthood because they do so much work for women, particularly poor women. And there are so many poor women in this country and growing numbers of them. Now, you know...
But if you don't care about poor women, you have no heart.
Yes. Now, these Republicans are so stupid. This Republican from this representative, John Fleming from Louisiana, he deleted his Facebook post linking to an article in The Onion. You know, The Onion's a parody, but they're so good,
people don't realize. People mistake it as a real news story often.
So here was the deal. The Louisiana Republican alerted his followers to The Onion's May 18th, 2011 article. Think of how long ago that was. Planned Parenthood opens $8 billion abortion plex.
God. And people bought this.
Now, there's this blog called Literally Unbelievable that someone could believe this. And they ask on there, The Onion is satire. And they ask the congressman, how exactly did you get elected? The May 2011 Onion article details the opening of a, quote, sprawling abortion facility that will allow the organization to terminate unborn lives with an efficiency never before thought possible.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is the fictional abortion plex offers more than 2,000 rooms dedicated to the procedure, as well as coffee shops, bars, dozens of restaurants and retail outlets, a three-story nightclub, and a 10-screen multiplex theater. Features intended not only to help clients relax, but to foster a sense of community and make abortion more of a social event.
this
congressman from
Louisiana,
he believes it.
Yeah. I mean, what a Nimrod.
I think from this is a little bit ago. God, winter's back, isn't it?
It's here.
I'm getting my godfather voice. That this was in Virginia. They were going to pass a bill that will require pregnant women to undergo an ultrasound prior to having an abortion.
Isn't that sweet of them?
Yeah. Now, this has no medical basis whatsoever. What it's done is attempt to make women feel guilty to the point where they will not, their choice will be
to not undergo the procedure.
Yeah. And of course, this is mostly a male legislature that's
so
going to
push these guys.
The anti-abortion bill has found an enemy in State Senator Janet Howell, a Democrat from Fairfax, who has decided to fight back in protest of the mandatory ultrasound bill. State Senator Howell attached an amendment to the bill Monday that would require men attempting to obtain a prescription for erectile dysfunction medication like Viagra to first have a cardiac stress test and a rectal exam. We need some gender. We need some gender equity here, she said. The Virginia Senate is about to pass a bill that will require a woman to have a totally unnecessary medical procedure at their cost and inconvenience.
Yeah,
so, yeah, the woman has to pay for it too.
Oh, nice.
If we're going to do that to women, why not have that done to men? And the main sponsor of the bill, she said, she disagrees with it. I do believe that erectile dysfunction in this context is different from pregnancy. This guy ought to be on the same, what was that website about? Literally unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right. But, and that's what I mean. These right-wingers are driving all of us nuts. They are, every minute, they stay up nights. You know, most of us.
They're like a dog on a bone.
Yeah. We go to sleep. We go out and have fun. You know, they're just like up 24 hours a day. How can we make people more miserable? Oh, yeah. I mean, think about this thing with the Catholic Church, the nation's Roman Catholic bishops. They rejected this compromise. I'm thinking there goes Obama folding again. And here was the deal that as part of the national health program is that all employers are required to afford or to give, to make available to their employees contraception, birth control. Like that. Wow. What a concept. Just want unlimited babies in this world? I mean, one of the reasons there's so many abortions is because people can't afford them. That's one of the biggest reasons that women have abortions is, economic concerns. Now, what they said, we're going to find a way that we can compromise. So what's going to happen now is that instead of making Catholic hospitals and universities and service agencies that are Catholic in origin that have thousands and thousands of non-Catholic employees, instead of having them not have this available, that would be available to all other women in the country, he said, we'll have the insurance companies pay for this. And I thought, how the hell is he going to get insurance companies to pay for anything? Well, it turns out that insurance companies think that it's more expensive for them to pay for pregnancies than to pay for contraceptives.
Mm.
So they're down with it. So they're going to pay for, and you would think the bishops would say, okay, you know, that settles it, right?
Yeah, right.
Instead, no, this is no good. They don't like this.
Not.
Right. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, for one thing, they do these studies and about 90% of Catholics, guess what? Practice birth control. You know, people, we mentioned abortion before, but we've left that subject. We're talking about birth control, contraceptives. What century is this? Sometimes they say, what year is this? What century is this?
Yeah.
I mean, you have this religion that wants to deny people the control over their own reproductive pace.
Yeah, well, it's really, to me, it's a control thing. It's a repression thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is anti-sex.
They don't want people to have sex for pleasure because, really, its only purpose is procreation, right?
Yeah. And also, well, you know, I wonder what all the women... they don't have any.
Wait, there aren't any.
So, wait a minute. So, it's all these celibate... usually celibate. Most not go there. Mostly celibate. I'm sure that... I mean, a good 40, 50, no, I mean, probably a good 90, 95% of them are celibate. All right, maybe 98%. I mean, we hear some.
Can they do by themselves?
No. It is better to sow thy seed in the belly of a,
It's a good thing people can't see my hand gestures. Only you get that pleasure, no pun intended.
Right. Right. But it is, in the Bible it says something is better to sow thy seed in the belly of a whore than let it dribble on the ground.
Gross. Okay.
I don't find it so gross.
Well,
I mean, it's their opinion.
I guess it's my twisted mind.
I mean, it's what? Masturbation is what? Sex with somebody you love.
Me. Wah. I mean, you know, in a general sense.
I mean, you yourself. You don't mean me.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, right. That's, what is that?
Moving right along.
So this is horrible, and this is what I mean. This is why I'm going to give money to the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Let's see. Churches and houses of worship that object to birth control coverage, they're already exempted. Also, and by the way, the bishops are now facing a potential rift with some of their allies who welcomed the compromise, including Catholic Charities, the Catholic Health Association, and that represents Catholic hospitals across the country, and also all these individual Catholic Democrats and liberals who help persuade the administration to make the change. So what is up with these guys? And guys is the deciding...
definitive word.
The definitive word here. So, let me see. I got a paper clipper on this. What else is on this?
It was a rough week for my ovaries.
Yeah. Well, no.
My uterus.
Yeah, yeah. But here's what, I mean, these Republicans, too, they jumped all over it because they thought, now we can, you know, drive a little wedge into the Obama support. And so,
any chance they can get.
In Centennial, Colorado, there's Mitt Romney, who used to be a big supporter of abortion and was pro-choice. And certainly,
not anymore.
Yeah. He says, think what that does to people in faiths without sharing those views. This is a violation of conscience, he told a crowd of...
disgusting!
2,500 people packed into a gymnasium. Man, if that guy was in my backyard, I wouldn't raise the window shade.
Me neither.
Okay.
I'd call the cops.
Now, get this. I mean, this is what I mean. They're always... these Republicans are filled with misinformation. I mean, they have such low information supporters to begin with. And rather than trying to increase it, they delight in the decrease of it and play upon their fears, which comes out in this social rage against other people. And, I mean, this is what proto-fascism is. I'm not saying these people are all fascists, either the candidates or the supporters. But when you hear some of this rhetoric calling, you know, Obama a traitor, that he's not a citizen, that I was just listening to this frightening show, this right-wing show that they were broadcasting in Detroit about guns. I mean, it was centered on guns, which wasn't a technical show. Wasn't about hunting, wasn't about just, this gun does this.
Going to the range.
Going to the range. People are collectors. People use them want them for home defense and all. This was completely right-wing political. Just ramping up this idea that Obama, who's never done anything to limit gun possession
at all.
They say, he gets in again, he's going to strip everybody's guns away.
I mean, why do they think that? These people are so paranoid and crazy. Yeah.
Well, they are paranoid and crazy. And proto-fascist means, on the way to, like an egg is a proto-chicken.
Becoming.
Yeah, exactly. So here's what Romney says, not knowing in the slightest what he's talking about. We must have a president who is willing to protect America's first right, a right to worship God. And that's not what the first right is. I mean, he's talking about if he's talking about the Bill of Rights, he doesn't say that, but the first right, when these rights are granted, the first statement in the Bill of Rights says that Congress shall make no law establishing religion.
How many times do we have to go over this?
And the idea that bishops could intervene their, you know, medieval religious views in a modern society based on a secular democracy is so far beyond me. You know, remember too, and I don't have it in front of me. I could go to my briefcase. Says I always, like, just like a right winger, I always carry a copy of the Constitution, and it says that there shall not be a religious test for political office ever.
And it's weird. And now it's the biggest test ever. I bet these guys smell like mothballs. I don't know. You know what I mean?
No.
I don't know. When I think of these old creeps, I just smell mothballs.
Well, and you think about it, it's an odd construction of a sentence. I mean, it's not like you would think they would have just said there shall never be a religious test for office. But then they put in ever. I mean, like, they almost anticipated
that there would be an issue.
That there would be these religious fakes. I mean, do you really think that any one of these Republicans, with their great commitment to their devotion to the Lord and all that, that they're
morality.
Serious? Yeah. I mean, I don't believe Obama. You know, Obama probably, if it wasn't that he was the president, probably would never go to church, right?
Well, I believed that about George Bush. I don't know about Obama. I don't know.
Yeah. Well.
Not sure.
So, yeah.
It was an interesting week.
It was.
Around the world.
But they were losing big time all over the country, the right wing.
Yeah.
The federal appeals court in California struck down the state ban on gay marriage.
Proposition 8. And that one, boy, that was a nice surprise.
Yeah, that was. And there was this joyous celebration in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which is probably one of the most heavily gay cities
and
gay-friendly city and what have you. And you had, of course, people joyous in the ability to express love and to be accepted as included into the society.
Yeah.
Rather than being marginalized, rather than being the objects of scorn and sometimes even physical attack, insults and jokes.
Well, and sometimes even murder and death.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're particularly like a white male like me, you really don't know what it is to be, and I don't, I mean, for sure, you know, I'm the dominant class, without a doubt.
The white man.
The white man, yeah, although I, never mind. People are going to think this is not about sex.
No, it's not.
We always talk about race. Pardon me. So one of the things that the right wing is frothing about, and this is it, fear and rage, and this is the basis of fascism, and it gets manipulated by insane politicians. We saw it in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s and what it came to fruition as. And the same thing is happening here with the future of this country being so unsure, so indefinite. And the idea, and whose fault is it? Well, these people are thrashing around. All they want is everything to be like they thought it was yesterday.
It's the socialists!
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they want it to be like how it was under Clinton, right? They won't say that. But essentially that, where their position financially and socially, politically, all of that was not threatened. And so I was listening. I just accidentally tuned into this right-wing station, and I heard this right-wing character inveighing against Ellen DeGeneres, who is now the spokesperson for JCPenney. Oh, that's the other thing. I've never been in a JCPenney in my life. I'm going to go shopping there.
Yeah, I am too. And that group of 1 million women or what they... There was a group that calls themselves 1 million women or something like that.
I got that.
And they said, you know, boycott JCPenney because, I mean, these people truly are sick in the head. They are hateful, hateful people spreading hate. And
the fact that
these women have children who they are filling their little sweet little heads full of hatred like that and bigotry and ignorance is really just such a sad thing to me.
Now, this commentary, and I won't mention the name and I won't mention the station because I don't want to give them any publicity whatsoever.
Don't.
It was so frightening in the denunciation of gay people and of Ellen DeGeneres, that if you would have, talking about the 1930s and fascism, if you would have, instead of gays, if you would have substituted the word Jew in it, you would have been right back in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
If you would have substituted the word black or colored You would have been right back in Mississippi in 1961 or something like that. I mean, that is the level of discourse that now can be broadcast over over Detroit radio, this bastion of liberal thought, just toxic speech.
You said liberal thought.
Did I?
You did.
Well, that's why one of the many reasons you're here.
Okay. I just had to straighten that one out.
Okay. What did I say?
He said a bastion of liberal thought.
Oh, no, no. Detroit's a bastion of liberal thought.
I thought you meant what this radio station was talking about.
Okay. Yeah, here.
With you.
And here, this gives you an idea. Here, this is so, I mean, here's an obscure name, which you may or may not know. It's Alan Turing, who was born 100 years ago. He's a British mathematician and cryptanalyst, regarded as one of the central figures in the development of the computer and artificial intelligence, was denied a formal pardon by the government of right-wing Prime Minister David Cameron for his conviction, not for Cameron's, but for Turing's conviction in 1952 on charges of homosexuality that was a criminal offense in Britain at the time. They petitioned for a pardon for Mr. Turing, who committed suicide by eating a cyanide-laced apple in 1954 when he was 41, because he was publicly pillared for his
sexuality.
For his sexuality. And this is what comes of it all.
And this new prime minister, or relatively the latest one, David Cameron, won't even give the guy a pardon post-mortem all these years?
Yeah. So the idea that, and by the way, always the right wing, Jillian and I despise these right wing politicians, and would like to see popular uprising against them that drive them back to the extreme margins in which they were kept for generations.
In the cave.
Back until Reagan and his pals began to release them, and it really came to the fore under Clinton and then, of course, under Bush. But Jillian and I do not hate conservative people. We unfortunately have friends here at the radio station that are conservatives, and we think their ideas are stupid. We argue with them all the time.
Disturbing.
But we don't want to do anything to them. We don't call them traitors. We don't call them degenerates.
Well, we don't hang out with them.
You do.
Yeah. Well, one of them. Some for sure.
I do sometimes as well. But just as Jews, just as blacks, just as so many other minorities throughout the world are under the gun, so are people that don't fit this right-wing view of who can be included. And these are dangerous. And, I mean, add to that, I was saying before about this right-wing gun program, this emphasis on militarism and armaments and what have you. I mean, this is the stuff of fascism, people. And we're entering a period where, like I said, it's pretty unknown. Are we at halftime in America?
Oh, my. How about that whole eruption of craziness after that? The Republicans went after old Clint Eastwood and the whole ad. It was ridiculous.
I know. I mean, that's what I mean. You could, I go through the news sites and go through newspapers, and I'm thinking, don't these people ever sleep? Don't they let anything slide?
You know? Do they ever smile?
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're on the way to the bank.
Yeah, right. But some of these people, let me see, on the way to the bank, where is that? Oh, yeah. Let me see if I can get this. Hey, Mo, Mike, Michael and Mike. Wow.
Really?
Mo, Mike, Michael and Mike.
Interesting.
They're all from different places.
These are the people who are on hold, by the way. That's what we're talking
Hang
about.
Hang on. Hang
we're
on,
gonna get you,
and we'll
no,
get
hang
you on.
On.
But we're going to go to a break first. But I want to leave you with this. Let me see if I'll leave you. Yeah, okay. This is worth reading a little. Remember those teabaggers? Remember the Tea Party movement? We used to call them the teabaggers and all that? You do? Come on. You know, it's like a history lesson.
I mean, they were so popular that we just brought it down to baggers.
Yeah.
Yep. People knew what we were talking about.
And the most famous sign that any of them ever had was, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Remember that? Right.
Right then. Well, here's an article in the New York Times yesterday. In Lindstrom, Minnesota, Kai Gulbranson owns a logo apparel shop, deals in jewelry on the side, and referees youth soccer games. Makes about $39,000 a year and wants you to know that he does not need any help from the federal government.
Oh, really?
Sounds like a teabagger, right?
Sure does.
He says that too many Americans lean on taxpayers rather than living their own within their own means. He supports politicians who promise to cut government spending. In 2010, he printed T-shirts for the Tea Party campaign of a neighbor, Chip Kevrak. And, in fact, the guy won, beating a long-serving Democratic congressman. Yet this year, as in each of the past 3 years, Mr. Gulbenson, 57, is counting on a payment of several thousand dollars from the federal government. You know, like Michelle Bachmann. So
yeah.
She got all that money from him. He also gets a subsidy for working families called the Earned Income Tax Credit. He has signed up his three school-aged children to eat free breakfast and lunch at federal expense. And Medicare paid for his mother, 88, to have hip surgery twice.
Oh, my. So,
So they describe themselves as self-sufficient members of the American middle class and as opponents of government largesse and are drawing more deeply on that government with each passing year. Well, it's all those poor people are the one that are sucking everything up. You know what? It's not true.
No.
I would have said...
How long?
Did you? I didn't.
That it wasn't.
No, I would have thought, well, who should get the most money? Poor people,
yeah,
right? They need it the most.
I agree.
No, but it's not. Let's see. Where is this in here? Oh, yeah. The share of benefits flowing to the least affluent households, the bottom fifth, up to 20%, has declined from 54%. That's who was getting it in 1979. Mm-hmm. To 36% in 2007. So 64% of it go to the middle class.
Yeah. And that's what I meant, Peter. I think you mistook what I said.
Okay. All right. We're going to come back, get all the mics on the air. We're going to open the mic to you
well.
And also, I want to just ask you a question. What do Israeli music fans want? Let me see. How can I put this? What do Israeli music fans what are they asking the
the government
to do before they attack Iran?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me help.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hey, moms, if your child's birthday is right around the corner, then listen up, because the next 60 seconds will save you time, hassle, and money. Don't waste your valuable time wandering around the party supply store. BirthdayExpress.com has you covered with everything you need to make your child's next birthday the best one ever. From favors and treats to balloons, games, and decorations, BirthdayExpress.com has it all in stock, ready to be shipped directly to you, fast and easy. Even better, go to BirthdayExpress.com today, use promo code PARTY, and get 15% off everything. Doing a theme? Birthday Express has an enormous selection, including brands you can't find anywhere else, like WWE, Mario Kart, and Yo Gabba Gabba. If your kids are talking about it, we have it. Birthday Express makes it fast and easy for you to be the super mom you are. You can even personalize your party supplies with a child's name or picture. How cool is that? Just go to BirthdayExpress.com today and use code PARTY for 15% off. That's BirthdayExpress.com. Promo code PARTY. BirthdayExpress.com. Code PARTY.
If you're overwhelmed by debt and thinking about going to a credit counseling company for help, think again, because the majority of those companies actually work for the credit card companies, and they make the credit card companies a lot of money from people just like you. But there's another way out of debt, and it's not bankruptcy, a way to reduce your debts and save you thousands of dollars. Even better, you can find out how for free by calling 1-800-941-9246. At Freedom Debt Relief, we're not a credit counseling organization. We're not a debt consolidation company. We offer a unique alternative to save you the most money possible to resolve your debt in the shortest amount of time. If you're thinking about a credit counselor, ask yourself this. Are they working for you or the credit card companies? Reduce your debts and save thousands of dollars by learning the secrets to settling your debt. For free information, call 1-800-941-9246. That's 1-800-941-9246. 1-800-941-9246.
Detroit Rock Station. On the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Don't take no risk. Don't take.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. And we've been talking about a lot of stuff, mostly just raving on the right wing. What a nuisance these people have. You know, they have always been in the way of progress. Remember, I'm going to go off on this little rant, which you've heard a lot of times before. If it was up to them, we'd still be a colony.
Yeah, no doubt about
it. Of Britain.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the conservatives were the Tories. They were for slavery. They were against the right of women to vote. They were
Right of women to do anything.
Right. They were.
Have their babies.
They were for segregation, even though I know they were Democrats. But, now they're all Republicans. The same people that wanted segregation have gone for the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, of course. And they're against rights for gays, for women, for everybody. You know, they're just an impediment. You know, you gotta get the hog out of the stream if you want to drink clean, clear water.
Sadly, it's not that easy.
All right, so we were asking the question, what are Israeli music fans asking their government not to do until a certain date? And what they're doing, Israeli fans beg the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, to hold off an attack on Iran till after the Madonna show planned for the Queen of Pop on May 29th.
Wow.
Got an interview about that at 1 a.m., too.
Okay.
There was.
I thought that was really, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was The Onion, you know?
What was that website called?
I can't remember.
Incredible or something like that. Anybody believe that? Well, it was in, Haaretz. You can go to Haaretz.com, Haaretz.com. A liberal Israeli newspaper and website. Jerry writes in, Peter, I'm hoping you'll play songs like Blue Collar Man, Sticks, you know, working class tunes.
We like working class
tunes. So what are they?
Working Class Hero.
By John Lennon.
Yep.
Blue Collar by Bachman Turner Overdrive. The Clash Must. But all of a sudden there's a lot. Well, how about helping us? Either email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Or,
let's talk about some Pete Seeger, you know?
Well, let's do the rock genre.
Okay.
Minimum Wage by the Busboys, although I don't know that a lot of people know that
one.
And David Rovics, who we're talking about, is going to be in Detroit at AJ's Music Cafe in Ferndale on February 29th with special guest Jolene Jordan.
Me.
Yeah, and he has Minimum Wage Strike.
Oh, that's a great song. I love that song.
You know, he has written hundreds and hundreds of songs, and sometimes I've asked him to sing songs. He's, I can't remember it.
Yeah, he has so many. But he has a little, he has them all in a binder. So
yeah, maybe
if
we'll
people request old songs, he'll play them for you.
Remind me, I'll bring that. I love that Minimum Wage Strike song.
I'd love to play more of his stuff on here. In fact, there was something going on his Facebook. He wrote a new song about not getting played on the radio because people ask him all the time why he doesn't get played on the radio. And I came in and I said, hey, listen, I have to say, we play him on our show. So.
Yeah. By the way, David writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com, not David Rovics. Hi, Jolene and Peter. Check out the new book about this topic, Plots Against the President,
FDR.
FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, by Sally Denton, a socio-political analysis of right-wingers in the U.S. then and now. Of course, at one point, the right-wing were planning a military coup against President Roosevelt back then. I mean, these folks are dangerous, and they're getting more and more into a froth, right? Where is that other, was it just that one? Was it
The Joke?
The Joke, yeah. From Scott and Clinton Township writes, a conservative, a liberal, and a moderate walk into a bar. The bartender says, what'll you have, Mitt?
I like that
what
one.
What a fraud that guy is.
Thanks for that, Scott. And you're a chef? I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. All right, let's take some calls. Some of you have been waiting a really long time.
Peter.
Okay, we're going to do it in order. Here is Mo. Mo's in Detroit. Mo, thanks for being so patient.
Hello,
waiting.
I call Peter and Jolene.
Oh, it's Maurice.
Yeah. I'd like to speak about the death of a Whitney Houston.
Better be nice.
But the thing about it is, it's going to get kind of harsh at the end. You still there?
I'm here. I'm waiting for you.
Okay, you got money, fame, and all this. When you take it all away, you got your typical crackhead. She could have did anything with her spare time, the smoke dope, and that probably caused her to die because that hard drugs over a period of time will weaken your immune system.
Well, let me ask you that question, Maurice. Why do you think it is, and I don't know the answer to this, or maybe just a few suggestions, why do you think so many successful people in the entertainment industry have such problems with addiction, and they really are disproportionately high in terms of how many people have? What do you, I mean, something about
more
the creative spirit.
More than, say, accountants.
Yeah, accountants.
They're bored, don't have nothing else to do.
Think it's,
the only thing they can do,
they got a lot of money,
is get high.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there are a lot of creative types who are just...
Right.
Drawn to chemicals.
Peter, are you still there?
I'm here. I'm waiting for you.
We're right here.
You take Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor would not have been as funny as he was that old girl. It's like that song, too. It's on one of these songs, they say, if all your movies record was not really high effing on drugs. You know what I'm saying?
I do. Well, that is a question. So let's pose that to people. Thank you, Maurice. I think that, like I said, I think that a lot of people, and you have, it comes with the territory. You know, you say someone's obsessional. You know, you think that's, they're obsessing, in a bad way.
Right.
But what that means is you're going to play the guitar or the violin or if it is an instrument or the piano, and you're going to practice 3, 4, 5 hours a day.
Yeah. I also think a lot of artists are somewhat tortured souls inside when you listen to a lot of the music that people write.
Well, that's I mean,
I really believe that.
Think about how many people from the 60s and 70s era that was lost to drugs. Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. And,
and they're sensitive individuals. And I think when you mention that era, you think about how they dealt with seeing what was going on with Vietnam and things like that. You know, they take it on. They take the world on. I tend to take the world on myself, but fortunately I have friends who remind me, Julene, it's okay to be concerned about something, but you cannot take this on personally.
We have some open lines. People are getting discouraged and hanging up, so that gave some open lines.
Get on there, Peter.
Hang on. We'll get to you. 313-298 WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Here's Mike in Walled Lake as we start our parade of Mikes and Michaels. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, Mike. Oh, yeah. Mike from Walled Lake.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Turn your radio all the way off.
All the way off?
Yeah, all the way off.
Is that good?
Yeah, that's good.
There.
Go ahead.
Better?
Right.
Perfect.
No, I'm kind of curious.
Now we're on speakerphone.
Dude, no speakerphones.
No speakerphones.
We need to give you the set of rules. We don't have that many.
All right, wait, but I'm going to put you on hold there. I didn't get that. What was that?
It sounded like,
Athena or Sarah, if you can deal with it.
Tell them to get off speakerphone and we'll put them back on.
Yeah. Here's Michael in Fenton. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter and Julian?
We're good.
Michael.
Hey, I got something to say about Madonna, but I called about Mitt not being a Christian. Madonna isn't all that anyways. When I was 17, I could have hooked up with Madonna. When she was 19, I turned her down. So you tell them Israelis, it ain't all
slam.
That.
Me too. I turned her down.
Me too.
I'm from Rochester Hills, and she was in Rochester, but... The myth thing is, if you're a Christian, you're supposed to model yourself after Jesus. And if you do that, you walk in love. You don't insult people. You don't talk bad about people. You don't have to say the things that he's saying and live the way he's living. And so if you're with God, that's how you conduct yourself. And Mitt is not conducting himself that way. So he's not fooling me. I'm a Christian. I try to live like Jesus, be good to everybody, love everybody, don't steal from people, and don't talk about them behind their back, and try to bless them, even the people that are on the other side.
Well, Mitt's a Mormon. Does that make a difference?
No, I mean, they've got the same basic tenets, and every religion and every spiritual calling in the world says essentially the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you.
I do that without being a Christian.
Yeah, I know. And, of course, the golden rule in this society is he who has the gold rules.
Do you ever feel, do you ever feel guilt when you get calls like this, that when we're getting the list of Christian ways?
Thank you, Michael. You were the only other Mike hung up. Well, wait a minute. Maybe we have.
Let's see if, how here, he's Mike, doing. Let's
here's
see.
Mike from Walled Lake. Mike, you got it going?
It's about damn time.
And now he's irritated.
I've been waiting for freaking ever, man.
Well, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes.
For like 1 second. You know, just 1 second.
What, you want me to hold on?
Now we're holding?
I'm sitting there, I'm like, I thought you hung up on me, man.
No.
What's on your mind tonight, Mike?
Well, you know, we've talked about this in the past with the Middle East and our gas prices and our oil prices and, you know, all this corn oil. We have enough acres to plow some corn oil up. But
ethanol?
You know, we make gas out of that corn. But regardless, we're buying all this oil off the Middle East, and I'm just trying to figure out why we're doing that. Have you ever been to Dubai lately?
Have I been to Dubai lately?
No, but I have to say, a friend of mine just got back from Dubai about 3 days ago.
Okay, did she look out in front of her? I'm assuming she was in, like, the 60th floor.
I don't know. It was a he, and I don't know.
I'm assuming he looked out in the ocean and seen all the states that they're building with nothing but manpower and taking all this earth and putting it out of the ocean and building a replica of the United States in the ocean.
Yeah, they're this island. Yeah, they're doing all that. But, you know, the majority, I think you know that, Mike, the majority of the oil we import is from this hemisphere. The biggest oil supplier is Canada, then Venezuela.
Yeah.
You know, so, but we ought to get off oil.
We get 40% of our oil from Venezuela.
Do we?
I believe so.
There goes Citgo.
Yeah, that's where we go.
Yeah, we go to Citgo. I go to Citgo. Yeah. All right, Mike, thanks for your opinion. I'm glad you got on the air. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Corey in Ann Arbor. Corey, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. It's actually Rory. But
hi, Rory.
Hi, Rory.
I'm grateful that I'm talking to you guys.
You're a grateful dead what?
That's right.
I said I'm grateful that I'm talking to you guys.
Oh, you're grateful. Okay. I thought you said you're a grateful dead something.
No. So I'm calling in regard to the question you asked regarding the creative types versus the high amount of addiction.
Yeah.
Being that I'm from Ann Arbor, I see a lot of people in the recovery program. And I think what it really boils down to in the end is that there are a lot of addicts, period. It's just that the more famous you are, the more publicized your life is.
Oh, well, sure.
You know, the asking that kind of question is the same kind of concept as asking why is it that so many people that are famous cheat on their wives versus people that aren't. The numbers are probably virtually identical. It's just that the more popular you are, the more people are going to notice you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sure true. But, you know, there is like a methadrine epidemic in rural America, small town America.
A what?
Methadrine. Meth.
Oh, crank. Methadrine?
Isn't that what you call it?
Is that what it is? Methamphetamine.
Yeah. Methamphetamine. What's methadrine?
I don't know.
Must be something. All right. Come on, guys. What's methadrine is something else. It's methamphetamine. Anyway, it's something. What about, are we getting any, never mind. So people, one of the things that addiction does, whether it's alcohol or cigarettes even, or sometimes even coffee, but more things that where people do a lot of intoxicants. It's self-medicating. And the America's being stripped, you know, ripped out from underneath. And it's happening in many ways in rural America, small-town America. And so I don't know what it is, whether, I mean, the drug of choice being meth, which leads to such...
I think some people are bored in small-town America.
Well, if you're doing meth, you're not bored, at least for a while. That's for sure. Yeah. All right, Rory, thank you very much. Appreciate it. A lot of struggling cities are turning to the weed as a source of income, as many of you have suggested, that if you would legalize and tax marijuana, for instance, forgetting about the other stuff, but marijuana, a very powerful but mostly harmless substance, certainly much less harmful, even when abused, than alcohol.
Yeah.
And because one of the things is you don't have to abuse alcohol in order for it to be dangerous. In other words, driving, right?
So the absolutely,
you know, the best person in the
world.
That's
why you're my driver.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm your designated driver at a staff meeting.
Yeah, and people are thinking, what? Drinking at a staff meeting? It's radio, man.
Yeah. In Oakland, California, the city has raised taxes on marijuana dispensaries several times in the past few years, and last year it collected $1.4 million in taxes from them, almost 3% of all the business taxes it collected. Now it plans to double the number of dispensaries it licensed, and it just kind of goes on. Colorado Springs collected more than $700,000 in taxes from the medical marijuana industry in 2011. Wow. Denver collected more than $3.4 million last year, but... You know, when you get down to having an economy that's going to be increasingly based on gambling casinos and receipts from marijuana.
Yeah.
What?
And lottery.
The lottery. What's that?
What is it?
Yeah. There, you may want, we talked to a lot about, medical marijuana. New Michigan-based Medical Marijuana Coalition, the National Patients' Rights Association, has been formed by some of the nation's leading medical marijuana advocates to protect patients' rights. And it got a nice handwritten letter. I love those. We barely get those.
Very rare.
You can send those either to me or Jalene or both of us at 1 Radio Plaza, Ferndale, 48220. And Sigrid writes to us in part, keep up the good work. We, being she and her husband, Ron, listen every Sunday, but I can't participate much anymore, much to my sorrow. I can only walk with a walker now.
Oh, Sigrid.
Yeah, we love you indeed.
Yes.
I'm saying that.
Oh,
she's not
we love you.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
And she sent this information. She says, I guess you could mention on the program that George Soros totally agrees with you because it's a solicitation for the, about the drug laws. I can't even see what group. Oh, the Drug Policy Alliance.
Oh,
somebody
yeah.
we've interviewed a lot.
Yeah, very much so.
People that make a lot of sense.
I heard someone, Bailey Bedroa, our culture vulture, I like that, is going to call in about the Grammys. And I wonder, hopefully, or someone can tell us, I heard that Tony Bennett said something about drugs should be legalized.
On that, he was singing with, what's her name?
It was at a different time. I don't know who he sang with. I didn't watch.
Oh, yeah. All right. I saw her. I can't think of her name. I'm not, some style of music I'm not into.
Okay.
Here is Nick in Detroit. Nick, it's Peter and Jalene at 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on? Did I really get on?
Yeah.
You're really here.
All right. Hey, I love how you guys are talking about the working man. And usually, hey, Peter, I hear you in the morning, on the way to work. So
okay.
It's kind of weird talking to you at night, after the Red Wings game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And,
what happened?
How did the Wings do?
Oh, they won.
All right.
I mean, this is how many in a row?
Yeah. They beat the Philly.
Right on. Go Wings.
Yeah. But yeah, hey, the working man and stuff, that was great. Man, I love you. You guys were talking about him. It was great. And, I'm kind of stage fright here being on the air.
Don't have stage fright. Well, it's just your old pal Pete and Jalene.
Well, for one thing, never admit it.
but hey, I mean, you guys you're fighting for the rights, the working man, and I love
and that. Woman. Yeah, you got it.
But, by the way, let's back up just a minute, Nick. Somebody suggested that we play that Styx song, Working Man, but then we were saying...
Blue Collar Man.
What?
Blue Collar Man.
Yeah, we were talking... Oh, Blue Collar Man, right. And then there's...
Working Man by Rush.
There's Working Man by Rush. We were trying to think of either classic or contemporary rock songs that sing about the everyday worker. We kind of ran out. Anything going through your mind?
Hey, play that Rush song. I'll be happy,
Okay.
It's a good one.
We're going to be just yakking for a little bit, but we'll get back to it.
Right.
We're going to take a break, and let's get some more of you on the air. 313-298-WRIF. If you can believe this, Minnesota, a very, very liberal city, right?
Minnesota is a pretty liberal state.
St. Paul, Twin City.
Minneapolis, yeah.
And you got a guy, St. Paul, Twin City.
Sure.
And, aren't you? Don't you have some Minnesota connection?
I have a lot of family there.
Yeah. But You got a guy there, a councilman, that's flying a Confederate flag.
No.
Yeah. And
what a creep.
Tis right. Well, we'll talk about that when we get back. You join us at, well, here.
I have every right to loathe them, too.
We pay this guy to give you the information.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Are you over the age of 25 and need to lose more than 30 pounds? If so, the next 60 seconds are crucial to your well-being because Sensa is sending 30-day free trials to anyone looking to lose the maximum amount of weight. To experience the most dramatic weight loss results, you must be over the age of 25 and want to lose over 30 pounds. Call 1-800-963-2743 now and request your free 30-day trial of Sensa in a 6-month clinical study, one of the largest ever conducted of its kind. Participants lost an average of 30 pounds using Sensa, and now you can too. This weight loss breakthrough does not require added exercise or a change in your lifestyle, but act now. Due to overwhelming demand, there is a strict limit of one per household. Again, if you are over 25 and need to lose more than 30 pounds, it is crucial that you write down this number for your free 30-day trial of Sensa. Call 1-800-963-2743. That's 1-800-963-2743.
Yes. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Please join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. A lot of activity there. Appreciate all the people that are posting as well. Can they post? Well, I'm using this lingo like I actually know what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They can respond. And
sure.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, attack Iran. Israelis say not until after the Madonna concert. We're going to be interviewing Gareth Porter,
wow.
Who's a reporter, and he discusses whether or not Israel is going to attack Iran. In fact, also another author talking about living illegal, the human face of unauthorized immigrants. One of the things, you might not be around for that. I asked her, Why the objection to calling people, immigrant supporters, people on the mm-hmm. left, liberals, they refer to people that are here illegally
undocumented
or, as she says, unauthorized. And she said, you know, it's illegal makes it sound like it's some huge crime where it's actually equivalent to a misdemeanor for which they say, okay, you're not supposed to be here, and they ship
send
you
them back.
Yeah. So, but making them illegal. And the everything that I ever thought, and I've got a pretty good attitude about, you know, folks in general,
yeah.
Every negative thing you thought about unauthorized migrants, absolutely wrong. I mean, I was absolutely shocked
wow, okay.
at some of the information. Yeah, so it's good. That's
hey,
at 1 a.m. tonight. And what else do we got here? Nobody. Oh, I was looking for when I said methadrine, and I was Googling it during the break, and answers.com, someone asked, is methadrine the same as methamphetamine? And the answer was no. Usually they have like a whole explanation,
yeah.
right? No. They just said no. And then there's another one. Let me see. Maybe I got the... Oh, man, there's too many little buttons here. Okay, here. Methadrine, Google. This one says from rehabadvisors.com. Methadrine is another name for methamphetamines, which is a narcotic that is part of the group of drugs amphetamines and is illegal in the United States.
Well, yeah, pretty nasty.
Strictly
stuff.
Speaking, it's not even a narcotic, but all that stuff. So crazed. So here's a guy in the suburbs of St. Paul. A Minnesota city councilman has a Confederate flag hanging outside his home, and he says he's not taking it down no matter what people say.
Gross.
West St. Paul Councilman Ed Hansen told the Pioneer Press, that's the daily paper there, it's my house. What's the problem?
Well, you might want to look into the history a little bit there, ignorant.
I mean, at some level, people should be able to put up what they want. They want to put up a communist red flag. They want to put up a swastika.
Yeah.
Okay. But what kind of neighbor does that?
I would just
According to the city's mayor, John Zenmiller, a lot of problems. He says the flag, visible from a busy avenue and to visitors at a nearby park, also has the word redneck written across it. I mean, this is the right-wing mind at work. I'm going to offend people, and I don't care. I mean, there's certain things you got to take a stand on, but it's not like this is like a big issue. So suddenly, you could lie all year. Well, here's what he says. He says, I'm not a racist. I don't think it's racist. Well,
I don't think it. You might want to check into it before.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's the Confederate battle flag that was flown to support a slave nation. And that's what it was all about. He says it represents sovereignty, individual rights, and individual liberties. No, it doesn't. It represents slavery. It's the flag of the biggest traitors that ever occurred in American history. You take, these people that may have been spies for Russia or Benedict Arnold. I mean, those are one people. Here was all of these states that so wanted to maintain chattel slavery, human beings enslaved, stolen from Africa, brought here into the most horrible conditions, kept in slavery in terrible conditions, and that was the flag that represents it. And if you're flying that flag, I don't know what to say. Remember, I always say my great-great-grandpappy was wounded by one of these guys flying that, so I'm not real neutral on that at all. But you got to remember, the United States at its origins was a slave nation. It sanctioned slavery in its constitution. And people say, why in the world would the Jeffersons and the Sam Adams and the George Washington, they were slave owners.
Some people were like, what do you mean, the guy who made the beer?
Oh, Sam Adams. Oh, yeah. I'm thinking, is there a George Washington beer?
No, he was into hemp. That was his.
That's right. Choice. George Washington grew hemp.
Yeah.
But the reason that the South came along, because again, it was just filled with Tories, people that wanted to stay colonies of England. But in 1772, you ready for the history? This is going to be on the test. There was something in England called the Somerset decision, not to be confused with the Somerset Collection.
The Mall.
Yeah, the Somerset Collection, the Somerset decision. And a judge held that slavery could not be abided by, that English law, and given its the nature of it, that he freed this slave named Somerset. Well, this panicked the colonies in the South, the slave-owning colony.
Where's our help going to go?
Yeah, right. So then they decide, you're going to be a free nation, which to them meant they were going to be free to hold slaves. So the only reason that, and the North and the rest of the people that supported a grander view of, pardon me, wait, I can't wait till spring, a grander view of human freedom, they had to compromise with these Southern slave owners in order to get the colonies as a whole to revolt against England and declare its individual nation, and had to bend over to the demand that in the apportionment of representatives that they could actually claim this property. And that's what these human beings were from Africa. They were property. They could count them as two-thirds of a human being.
Oh, my gosh.
Terrible. And that's what...
It never gets any easier to hear that, ever.
No,
it's
and
horrible.
That's what that flag represents. And, maybe it represents... the moon colony of Newt Gingrich. Do you? Maybe you go, well, I didn't know any of that. God, it's a battle flag? Oh, it was from the Confederates? Oh, I didn't know that. Well, but it's very offensive to people.
Yeah.
And why in the world would you want to offend people?
You want to offend anyone on that level, especially?
And if you want to offend anybody, if you want to offend people, what the hell is with you? Do you know how hard life is in this world? Without you or this jerk in West St. Paul just making it even more difficult? I mean, I'm not trying to say change your beliefs
just don't fly it in the form of a flag in public.
And it is the flag of traitors.
Hey,
it
you know
is
what?
The
put
flag
it on your wall,
traitors.
Put it in your garage with your fridge full of beer. I don't care.
Yeah.
But don't fly it publicly.
Yeah.
And actually just don't fly it at all.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, do people have a right to fly flags? Yeah, there's a sniper unit in Afghanistan that's flying. You can see that on my website, flying an SS flag.
Oh, my gosh.
From the Nazi SS flag. And you can see that on my website, peterwerby.com. WRBE.com. Well, I don't know if this is what engendered the call, but here is someone calling themselves liberal in South Carolina, that the state which proudly still flies that vile rag. What do you, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. That would be apropos, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Hello. I'm looking at that flag on your website right now. And
the SS flag. Yeah.
Yes. I'm a retired Army sergeant, among other things, a Desert Storm veteran. That's freaking disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I live here in South Carolina. And flying the stars and bars, which is the Confederate battle flag, it is not the Confederate flag.
Right.
Thank you for pointing that out. It's disgusting. It's like flying a swastika.
Yeah, I don't think what? It's not. I have to say, it's not seen, and it's often seen as a symbol of rebellion. And I mean, among say people in the North, and it's in what it really is, it's seen as a symbol of rebellion against liberal ideas, that of tolerance and community and
great bringing, things like that,
and bringing everybody into the conversation and into the community,
inclusive.
Yeah,
I don't feel that it's very inclusive at all.
No. I maybe didn't.
I think you misunderstood what we said.
I may have not said that clearly. I mean, the opposite.
Liberal ideas.
Liberal ideas do all that. And this and that flag is rebellion against that sense of community and inclusion and tolerance and love.
Well, it's just a very disgusting symbol, and most sane people, not too many around here, unfortunately, hence my name, and that is my Twitter name.
Liberal.
But,
yeah,
liberal in South Carolina. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
not too many of us down here.
I should say, how do you survive? How do you do it?
It's a struggle. Trust me, it is a struggle.
You find shows like this on late on Sunday nights to bond with.
Thanks to some good people over at MikeMalloy.com.
Oh, yeah. Our buddy Mike Malloy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. They turned me onto you folks.
Great.
And. Yeah, we try to follow you guys because you're doing a great thing.
How many? What was the vote?
You.
I mean, in North Carolina, went for Obama in 2008.
Yeah.
What was the percentage of the vote for Obama? Do you happen to remember in South Carolina?
I do not. It was decent. It was close to 60%. But now they have redistricted, and guess what? I was reading this on the internet this afternoon. Ain't going to happen again.
No.
What?
Well, at least congressionally.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, they redistricted all of the decent people into a couple little pockets, and they're trying to do it here in South Carolina too. But
well, they're doing it in Michigan. They're doing it in Texas, and the whole idea is to run elections, gain electoral victories by putting hundreds of millions of dollars into these right-wing candidates. That's all there are. There are no moderate candidates anymore. And to essentially buy the presidency, suppress the vote, rig the voting machines, and essentially destroy American democracy.
We are 100% touchscreen, no paper trail voting machines here.
Yeah, which means and Republicans own all of these voting machine companies.
Yep.
So as we say in Detroit, the fix is in.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, liberal
okay,
states. Yeah. Go ahead.
Let me hold you for a couple minutes because you were talking about mentality of artists and
artists
all of
and addiction
that.
And creativity and all that.
Right. Among my many occupations, I used to work in Branson for
Missouri.
A country music artist. I was stage manager for 2 years for a stage manager who, or for a country music artist who just happens to be black.
Charlie Pride?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Kiss an angel good morning.
Kiss an angel good morning.
Love her like the devil when you get back home.
Yeah.
Did you know that he's manic depressive?
No.
Well,
I don't know a lot about him other than he's a singer.
Well, I'm going to tie this all together.
Go ahead.
Charlie had he went through a very dark time, and the man who hired me into that job told me that back in the day he wouldn't walk across the street and piss on Charlie if he was on fire.
Wow, that's
yeah,
harsh.
Yeah, he was that big of a butthole when he was drinking and doing things, but he finally got diagnosed. And he's on his medication now, lithium, and he's a super nice guy, maintain an even strain, kind of, you know, he's never too high, he's never too low.
Well, that's good.
Super nice guy. And to wrap all of this up.
I was going to say, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know I'm long-winded. Peter, the interview that you did last week with the gentleman about the Porter Train.
Larry Tye. You can go to Larry Tye, T-Y-E, LarryTye.com. Great site, great books that this man has written. Yeah.
If you ever take a weekend off, put that in your highlight reel, because that interview was awesome.
Yeah, I like
it.
Yeah.
And two things. Wrapping it all up.
Just let him go really quick.
Okay.
Let him go, Peter.
I had you faded down. All right.
Quick.
Go ahead.
He was a professional baseball player.
Who was?
Charlie Pride.
Oh, Charlie Pride. Really?
Yes. He was in the American Negro League. His wife of 50 years was a baseball groupie.
Wow. Okay.
Didn't know that.
And point two?
And the other reason about the port the railroad men,
the porters,
the reason why we wear name tags on our uniforms now and all these service things, that came out of the
porters,
the railroad strike. Don't call me George.
Okay.
Oh, interesting. All right. Well,
Liberal,
thanks for
we
coming
got you
to
potted down because you're an interesting guy. We could probably talk for a lot longer,
we
got to go.
I got
all
an
right.
email. We
thanks
got
for
an
calling.
Email from James in Kenosha, Wisconsin, longtime listener, and we're talking about songs for the working person. Justice says this one might be obscure. Power and Authority by King Short Shirt. You would probably know something like that, Peter.
That is pretty
and
obscure.
And closer to home, Steve Earle, Harlan Man, and America versus 6.0. I don't know that one. Career Opportunities by The Clash. Welcome to the Working Week by Elvis Costello. Factory, Bruce Springsteen, and Salt of the Earth, Rolling Stones.
Salt of the Earth, which actually was written by Joan Baez.
Oh, cool.
That's a great song. I was going to say, if you missed some of the allusions that Liberal from South Carolina was saying, I interviewed Larry Tye, who's written a book on Satchel Paige, the African-American great pitcher who at the end of his life was baseball career. I could have been in his 50s, was blowing balls 100 miles an hour past finally major league batters.
Mm.
And, you know, now, in fact, on that interview, it talks about that, you know, that they got to make sure, well, God, you know, take him out after six innings. He would pitch 5 and 6 days a week, 9 innings.
Wow.
And for like 30 years, he did this. And the other book that he wrote was about the Pullman Porters. The Pullman Porters were the guys that welcomed you onto
the
trains in the 20s. Well, no, going back to the 1880s and 90s through probably the 1960s. And at the beginning, they were all named. They had to be all called George after the George Pullman, who put together the Pullman car thing. And they had to be.
Wow.
They had to be dark complexioned and they had to be very obsequious. You know, they had to, you know, that thing you see in the movies from the 40s and all that. Mm-hmm. Except these guys, that old George Pullman, the rest of them bit off a little more than they can chew because they were really in the forefront of the civil rights movement way back when. They formed a union maybe in the 1930s. Mm. They were going to call a March on Washington in 1940 or 1941, and
really?
Finally President Roosevelt, always hamstrung, by the way, by these Southern racists who were, you know, the mainstay of the Democratic Party in the South, and he, you know, he had to give in to, because he didn't want this, you know, huge march, the kind that came, you know, years later with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, sure.
So incredible history. And when he mentioned the Negro League, it was called the National Negro League. They had a great Detroit team called the Detroit Stars. They had a stadium over on Mack Avenue, and Jackie Robinson played on the Kansas City Monarchs team and all that.
Hey, Brian in Berkeley wrote in. He's got a good worker song. Whistle While You Work by the Seven Dwarfs.
That is good. I want to tell you, I love James from Kenosha, but I got to tell you, those songs, James, pretty obscure.
Rolling Stones.
That was good. Salt of the Earth.
Yeah.
I forgot what album it's on. All right.
Well, that just says everything about the obscurity of working songs, Peter.
All right. 313-298-WRIF.
I got your back, James.
Is this the same guy? Hey, it's Mike from Well City, Michigan. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
What's up, Mike?
Hey, not much, man. I was just sitting there thinking about the Middle East a little bit.
Wait a minute, Mike. Were you on earlier?
Possibly.
Possibly. And he laughed.
One customer a night is the rule. Sorry, call back next week. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Bailey from Ferndale. I would have got you on early. I'm looking Granny update. I'm thinking Granny, like
Grammy.
It
Grammys.
Wait a minute, let me read this.
Look, Peter.
It says Granny.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Bailey Boudreau. Our culture vulture, we're calling you right
tonight. That's a compliment where we come from.
Well, apparently I'm calling to tell you about my grandma. She's fine.
Yeah, that's good.
Good, Granny.
Good as ever.
So you watched the Grammys tonight.
I did. I sat through all 3.5 hours of those babies.
Wow.
I fast-forwarded a lot. Okay, so quick recap. This is on the entertainment portion. First of all, LL Cool J was the host. He did a great job. They did an opening prayer for Whitney Houston, which I thought was actually really nicely done, even though I'm not religious.
Mm-hmm.
It was nicely done. The other tribute to Whitney Houston that they did, because clearly they had to do something, I was really nervous that someone was going to do I Will Always Love You, like Beyonce, God forbid, or Christina Aguilera, and then it would be all about, you know,
them
and their voice. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Like what Christina did with the Etta James tribute. She did that. So I saw the video of that, and it made my skin crawl.
So like, it's all about them. But luckily, they did actually do I Will Always Love You, and it was Jennifer Hudson who did it. And Jennifer Hudson could be anybody in a sing-off.
Girlfriend can sing, yeah.
Yeah, and she did such a stirring version of that song. She didn't go any high notes. She didn't belt anything, and you could tell it was all for Whitney. It was really beautiful.
Oh.
Okay. Moving on from that, Adele obviously took home everything, and she's so funny. You have to YouTube her final speech because she cracks me up. She was talking about snot coming out of her nose.
Really? Yeah, someone was mentioning
she's real.
That
I like
yeah,
her.
Yeah.
She's very real. She's also down like 50 pounds, and I hope they stop making everyone lose weight.
I know. It's like you get famous, and it's like, okay, well, time to lose the weight.
Oh, and speaking of losing weight, Kelly Clarkson, who is happy and curvy,
yeah.
She did an awesome duet with Jason Aldean. It's a song that has been out forever, but she sounded and looked flawless. I have a quick list of the things that should be, the performances that should definitely be YouTubed.
Okay.
If you're a Kelly Clarkson fan, Kelly Clarkson and Jason Aldean, Katy Perry's performance was awesome. Rihanna's performance was awesome. Alicia Keys and Bonnie Raitt did a tribute to
Etta James.
Yeah, Etta James. So look at that. And Nicki Minaj, I'm not a fan, but that was like the most fantastic theatrical performance. It was so reminiscent of Madonna and still like in Paradise.
Peter really loves great. Bonnie Raitt. He's met Bonnie Raitt before.
I have. Bonnie Raitt's incredible. There's somewhere or other on my website, there's a picture of me and Bonnie Raitt standing together.
Oh.
I gotta tell you, and people always say this before they make a criticism, but this is not a criticism. I don't hardly know any of those players. I was thinking, what about the Foo Fighters, man? They did a kick-ass version of
They
Never
won
Wanna
some
Die.
Awards.
They won four awards, four grannies, four Grammys.
They performed twice.
Did they? I only saw one.
Sir Paul performed.
Oh, he did.
He also farted.
What?
If you watch
Paul McCartney
first song, if you watch his first song, the romantic song or whatever, there's a huge fart that comes out.
No,
and I don't know if I'm sure it was just a sound malfunction,
Bailey.
But I'm not kidding. Look at it.
I don't know if I want to.
They did a Beach Boy thing, and there's a lot of
the Beach Boys reunited for this. For not watching TV, I know an awful lot because I read it all.
Yeah. Okay, now for the political twist.
Please,
oh, good.
Okay, so music today is such a mishmash. I have no clue what any genre is anymore.
Yeah.
Because everything is a crossover. Everything is a mix of this and that. I feel personally that the political parties have sort of become that way as well. There's a lot of flip-flopping and a lot of, I don't know. It's
craziness.
It's not as clear-cut as it used to be. And I think there's a good reason for it. And this is just my thought and my observation. But Obama got a ton of youth to come out and vote.
Yep,
true.
Record numbers of youth. Now, in my day, and definitely in y'all's day, when you were on the phone, you were on the phone. You didn't have text messaging. You didn't have Facebook, or you couldn't Google search things.
What are you saying? We're old, Bailey?
Somewhat elderly.
Let's get rid of him.
You're walking a thin line now.
I'm so used to the thin line. I live on it.
Okay, good.
What was wrong with dial phones?
Rotary.
Nothing. I honestly wish that the youth of today could experience that, where you didn't know all the time where people were, what they were doing. And I think communication is just no longer in existence. But anyway, my point, because I don't want to hold you guys up because y'all are so busy with the drunk people calling.
Bailey doesn't drink.
Okay.
Well, not anymore.
Right,
I
not
was
anymore.
One of those guys.
I don't drink anymore. Bailey, I don't drink anymore either. Than I used to.
Yeah, I used to. Not a good idea. But anyway.
All right, go ahead.
So, we don't, the youth of today feels very much more empowered than I think we did in our generation because of things like Facebook. The youth of today feel like their opinion matters and counts when they can update their status and have 15 comments on it. They also, I think, are not as easily swayed by things because there is so much information at their fingertips that they really do have to make a lot of decisions for themselves. I'm not saying the youth of today is by any means smarter or whatever than we were.
Right.
But I do think that we're not hearing from them a lot. And I think when when people come out and vote, I think the youth will definitely be there because they feel that they should be heard, that they have an opinion and it matters. So that's what I think about that. But also think about what they're exposed to, because it's very hard for me to think there's going to be a lot of conservative youth, considering that now when I was in high school, my senior year, Will and Grace came out. Will and Grace was the raciest TV show. I mean, you watch it now and you're like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, they were cutting edge at the time.
It was, and when I,
conservative youth, that sounds like a contradiction.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Bailey, we got to go.
Oh, God, I had such a good point. Y'all suck.
Let him make it, Peter.
Go ahead.
No, it's fine.
No, make it.
No.
Make it.
Oh, Now I forgot it.
Okay. Now, see, what did you do?
All right, Bailey.
Thank you, Culture Bailey. Culture Vulture.
Thank you very much. All right, we've been looking for working class songs. I found a very easy way to get them. But here's Greg in Lincoln Park. Hey, Greg. Hi, you're on the air. You've got an Alice Cooper song to talk about?
Yeah, there's a newer song that a lovely Alice put out in the late 90s called Lost in America, and that's basically telling everybody that without a job and without any kind of help, you know, we're not going to go anyplace, and that's what I feel the country's currently going through, and everybody just picking on each other and not trying to work together as a team, and that's what he's basically getting at that we're not talking about.
He was early on with it, right? 1999.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a song, too. It's called, I can't remember who, is it We Don't Make It Here Anymore? There, boy, we even played it a couple of times. But no, that's a good point. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Billy Bragg?
No, not Billy Bragg, an American. But
I do this every time you ask me about this song.
Every time I say a song.
Steve Earle?
You say, that's it. Every time I mention, I'm trying to think of a singer.
David Rovix?
No. But listen, you can just go to Songs About Working, and there's 9 to 5, Dolly Parton, A Hard Day's Night, The Beatles, Bang the Drum All Day by Todd Rundgren.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to work.
Yes.
I just want to like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't even know most of these. Blue Collar Man, Long Nights, we said that. Well, yeah. Boy. I'm going down. Flamethrower, that's about working. I guess I don't even know that Jay Giles Band. I don't even know the lyrics to it.
Right.
what else we got here? Get a Job by The Silhouettes. God Bless Saturday by Kid Rock. I don't know that one, do you?
Nope.
yeah, Hey Ho by The Seven Dwarfs. We mentioned that. Maggie's Farm by Bob Dylan.
Ooh.
Why didn't we think about that one?
Because there's, you know, it's hard to... There's only so much brain space, Peter.
Yeah, I know. So, Shift Work. That's the name of one. But then it goes down to the ones we know about. Working Man by Rush. Working for a Living. Huey Lewis in the News.
Sure.
Forgot about that one. The Loadout by Jackson Browne. You know, the live at the No Nukes concert. Very cool song. And on and on and on.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay. So that settles all of that. All right, we've got open lines for you. We're going to take our break at the half hour. And remember that $750 million Iraq embassy that you and I built? The permanent one in Baghdad that at one point people said they could see it from the moon, which turned out to not be true. I believed it. It's 104 acres, and you're going to be, you probably won't be shocked at what's finally happening to it. That's right, they're turning it into a McDonald's. No, but it has a McDonald's in it.
Yeah, it has a Starbucks, too,
but,
and a movie theater.
Yeah, but we'll tell you about that when we come back. Lots of other stuff as well. Mainly, though, we'd like to get you on the air.
Yes.
And here is the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Hey, we're back. Yeah, with our... Well, here, wait a minute. I think he is...
Turn it up.
Yeah. This is James McMurtry. We can't make it here.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze. One leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin. And now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock. They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just bust.
Kind of a grim song by James McMurtry.
It's a good song.
Yeah, it is.
And you can't hide from grim things ever.
I think he actually, someone remind me, I don't want to play the whole thing. I think he mentions Detroit in it. The mic just attacked Jaleen. And this is, he's doing acoustic. I believe the song that got a little airplay and all that was, wow, it's got 250,000 hits.
Was
it.
What?
So, a band. Amplified guitar and the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Here is Patrick in Marine City. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Sweet. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Sweet.
Yeah. What's up?
Hey, this is my first time, so I'm kind of new at this.
Okay,
well, welcome.
It's all right, welcome. Yeah, it's easy.
Thank you. Well, I have been listening to you guys' radio station for, like, a really long time, and this is, like, my favorite radio station.
Well, thank you.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Keith?
Oh, now you're listening back to yourself. Turn your radio off.
Because we're on a big delay.
Oh, okay.
So you got to turn it off.
All right, it's off.
It's hard not to...
You can listen. You know what you can do, Patrick, and everyone else? At noon today, on Monday, there'll be a podcast available, and...
You can hear yourself.
You can hear yourself.
All over again.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. So what's up? You got any comment on anything we've been saying?
No, not really.
Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Right. Oh, yeah.
And
somebody,
keep on listening to the
somebody, Jim and Warren writes in Dire Straits, Money for Nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Send your chicks for free.
Jeez,
that's what
I think I played that earlier today.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the whole idea was Mark Knopfler, the lead guitar singer-songwriter for Dire Straits, that he heard a guy was watching. He was in a store, like a TV store, where they got 100 of them, and this guy was saying, look, they don't do any, they get money for nothing, and they're chicks for free. You know, just kind of bitter, resentful.
About celebrities? Or
about celebrities, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And politicians.
It's true.
Yeah? It was celebrities? We get our money for nothing and our chicks for free?
Yeah. Indeed. Here is Bill in Mount Clemens. Bill, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Bill. Bill, you with me?
Bill.
Okay, Bill, I'm putting you on hold.
Where'd you go, Bill?
All right, here's the U.S. Embassy. Now, remember.
And we're talking about the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad.
Yeah, and one of the things I always try to be is very precise in language. Well, I think Bill may be ready. Let's get him. Bill in Mount Clemens, hi, are you on the air?
Yeah, this is Joe from Mount Clemens.
Joe, hi, Joe.
Joe, hi.
Hey, you guys. First time caller, long time listener.
Welcome.
Joe.
Okay, maybe you guys remember, I don't know if you mentioned it already, 5 O'Clock World by the Vogues.
There you go.
Okay, great.
And how about Working on the Chain Gang?
Oh, all right. The Pretenders.
How about this one? How about this one? There is, there's an album called Michigan Rocks. And there's a band called Sticks and Stones, and they do a great song called Rouge Plant Blues.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Oh, okay. When you mentioned that Sticks Anything? And Stones, I thought you might be talking about that Red Fox song on Sanford and Son.
Oh, geez. I haven't seen that show for a long time.
All right, Joe. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. So I try to be precise in my pronouns. And when I say we built the Iraq embassy, what that means is our taxpayer money went and built it. Cost $750 million. It was about $200 billion over budget. So,
and if that didn't say permanent presence in the Middle East and Iraq,
in the meantime, American GIs are dying, you know, wounded grotesquely. Tens of thousands more Iraqis are dying and horrendously wounded. The country is destroyed. The social
infrastructure,
the social fabric of the country is just shredded.
And nothing's any better. I mean, it is worse. Nothing's any better for the people.
It could actually, I mean, there's what kind of like something called political freedom, but nothing like this went on, what's going on now under this cruel dictator, Saddam Hussein. It was backed by Reagan and George Bush's first.
It's just the same thing with the Shiites and the Sunnis. It's the same thing.
Yeah. So, Saddam kept that at bay.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't that open conflict.
Right, but I mean, they didn't solve anything.
That's right.
We.
So, and there's also supposed to be, to keep this embassy open, there's supposed to be a $6 billion a year price tag.
Oh, my God.
So, you might ask, and I forgot how many employees. I mean, thousands and thousands of employees. And it's this little city on 104 acres. And there's 2,000 diplomats. What the hell are they doing over there?
I'd like to know.
Remember the call was no war for oil. That's exactly what it was. And all we did was wind up destroying this nation, creating grievous harm to our soldiers and to the Iraqi people. And this enormous embassy. More contractors are being killed, by the way, in Afghanistan now than GIs.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, that's because, I don't know what the numbers, what the breakout is right now. How many contractors? Now over in Iraq, it's more contractors than anything.
Get this. So we've already spent this money. And, by the way, so I'm saying there's all this horrible consequences that the average American experience. So all our tax monies went down this rat hole of this war in Iraq based on lies. All these casualties on both sides, and the contractors, not the individuals that are over there, but the contracting firms made billions. And so I always use this phrase, very important to understand. It's a wealth transfer. We created wealth through our jobs. It was taken in taxes. And then it winds up in Halliburton's hands. You know, that's the big construction company. Or I can't even remember all the names of all of them. Or all these security companies.
KBR?
Yeah, so they make a fortune. Other people die. I mean, this is horrible. And in the meantime, just the $6 billion annual price tag. In the meantime, they're laying off cops in Ferndale, closing libraries in Troy. All these states with shortfalls in their budgets.
And you can just hear these guys, I've got an opportunity to go make a killing over in Baghdad.
Absolutely. All right, we haven't even talked about this. Here's Roy in Bloomfield Hills. Roy, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hey, Roy.
What's going on with this tonight?
Are you smacking your lips, dude? What's up?
Sounds like a computer. He hung up. Yuck, stop it.
Isn't that what he was doing?
Yuck, that was awful.
Yeah. Maybe he was like eating.
I don't know, but Roy, if you want to get on, what did he want to talk about?
He wanted to talk about those Super Bowl commercials. That's another thing. Remember, if you've listened to the whole program.
Why did he hang up?
No idea.
Okay.
I was saying that the right wing, they pester you. They're pests. They're always bugging you about something. And so they went
about getting into your business.
They went, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. There was, we didn't even mention that. Let's not do this. There was a politician that had this commercial that was attacking Senator Debbie Stabenow.
Yeah.
Did you know this?
From Michigan. I think I know where you're going.
And they had an Asian actor, of Asian extraction, saying that she had brought all this money to China. because she had somehow destroyed jobs. Well, it was roundly denounced even by some Republicans as being racial, you know, that he was trying to, you know, racialize this.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I think he may have taken it off the air. But in the meantime, everybody was talking about it because this politician, and I'm not going to help him out, he might have had like 1% recognition among people before it, and now it could be 50 or 60%.
No.
So it was this overwhelming success.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For her.
For him.
For him.
The politician.
Because of the publicity.
Yeah, because everyone's talking about it. Yeah. That's why Roy, so that's why I wanted to talk to him. All right. Here's Fred in Detroit. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Peter. I know what commercial you were talking about. It was a girl who was talking in pidgin English.
Right. Yeah, sort of. I mean, hey, she may have, in fact, had an Asian accent. She was Asian, right?
So. Right, right.
But you're right. That they did not want someone who had a, you know, an Asian with an American accent or, you know, was an American.
Well, I called because you touched on something tonight when you talked about the scumbag who was, or the teabagger, who was taking the government benefits while decrying, you know, paying taxes.
Can you believe that I was saying earlier that these people, all these teabaggers, they're getting all this money. The middle class is getting 2/3 of government funding.
Well, I happen to see interview with a Bruce Bartlett. He was the economist behind Reaganomics, you know, a real Republican darling.
Oh, yeah. I remember that name now. Yeah.
Right. And he wrote a book, just wrote a book called Imposter about George Bush.
Really?
Talking about the 43. And he's talking about how the man cut taxes and spent like crazy. And then you just mentioned the downsized embassy over in Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, he also goes on to take a slap at Grover Norquist and all the pledge idiots who signed that pledge.
Not never to raise taxes.
Right.
Yeah.
And he takes a swing at the lobbyists who outnumber Congressman 24-1.
Huh.
And this horrible punitive student loan program and the whole lie of Republican, you know, the whole Republican lie on low taxes. So, you know, and this is a guy who's basically
was
owned by the conservatives now.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah.
It was him. I mean, does he show any remorse from having set Reaganomics in motion?
Yeah.
What he does, which has destroyed the American economy.
And he's basically saying with you, and I've been saying when I call in, that these people out here, these Tea Partiers, they are so divorced from reality and not understanding what taxes are for. They're not understanding that, you know, that the services that they get are for their benefit.
They don't understand a whole lot,
yeah.
That's for
right.
Sure.
Fred, here's some interesting statistics. According to the Census Bureau, half of us now live in homes where at least one person gets a federal benefit, either Social Security, workers' comp, unemployment, subsidized housing. And
half the people, he said?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's up a few points from when Obama took office. Well, yeah, you would think so because he got left with a recession or a depression that's almost hard to get out of. This year, more than 46 million, 15% of all Americans will get food stamps. Well, it's another result of a Republican. That's a result of Reagan economics. Disability. The number of people on Social Security disability has steadily climbed since the 1970s. I'm not sure what the point of all this is, maybe just information. The government's role in health care has now grown over the past decades, with 45% of all health spending now coming from the federal government and will probably increase with, it should be 100% as far as I'm concerned, right?
Right.
Yeah. And let's see, corporate welfare, so it says that. The federal government was dishing out about $92 billion a year in corporate welfare programs in the form of subsidized loans, special tax breaks, bailouts, and the like. And Obama has added to this largesse. Federal grants to the energy sector quadrupled. You know, that maybe isn't so bad because the energy sector is although that, what was the name of that firm, didn't work out too well.
Enron.
Not Enron. No, that this one that the Republicans are all over, that it was an alternative energy. Huh?
Centigro or
something. So,
yeah, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
But also, he is, I don't know whether he exactly signs off on this or whether this is Congress or whatever, but they're going to build these $18 billion nuclear facilities. New nuke plants. What a good idea.
Oh, my God.
What a good idea. And these are the first ones that have been cited, you know, since, I think, the late 70s.
And in Georgia, is it? I didn't let you finish, Peter. I heard about that this week, and my heart sunk.
And the only way that these companies can, well, the whole way the nuke industry only could function right from its beginning is with these, federal loan guarantees, and secondly, that the government would pick up the insurance in case of catastrophic accidents.
Well, he also, besides basically saying that the Republicans just, lie like rugs and can spread so much misinformation, he basically said that if George Bush hadn't spent like he did, the deficit would be probably $2 trillion less right now.
Well, mainly from, it wasn't even so much spending as it was that when George Bush came in, he started two unnecessary, unfunded wars that cost a few trillion, and also cut back taxes on his rich buddies that put us in the hole. I mean, we got to keep saying this over and over again. Is in his State of the Union message in 2000, President, why was I thinking George Clinton? I'm
Bush.
Thinking about music. No.
Who are we talking about?
Clinton. What's his first name?
Bill.
Bill. I'm thinking George from the Funkadelics.
I'm so confused.
Yeah. I'm so confused, too. But Bill Clinton, the president, gave the State of the Union a speech in which he said, we have such a surplus. If we keep going in this direction, we will completely end the U.S. debt by 2012. And what that necessitated was going. Yeah. So what happened, though? Again, start these wars with no raise in taxes. In fact, lower them. I mean, what were these people thinking? There used to be an old expression that someone would say to me, and a conservative would say to me, well, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich? And we say, if you're so rich, how come
you're
not
smart?
Right? Wow.
Right. Yeah.
And Fred? I think you would agree that being rich isn't always monetarily. I mean, we're rich with great friends, great life, love.
I don't even think, I've known the people in my life that I've known that have not, that are in the 1%. I mean, all you got to do is what? Make like $375,000 a year. I know a few people like that. And they seemed to me, when I remember them, from when I was, a lot younger and in high school, even in some cases, they were kind of like the meaner kids.
I know. I went to a high school that was full of wealthy people, of wealthy kids. And, I feel kind of bad saying this, but they were mean then. And I see them on Facebook and they're even more awful now.
Well, Fred, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank
appreciate
you, Fred.
Your
we
call,
always
sir.
Appreciate you calling in.
Yep.
And I want to give a shout-out to a local band.
What's that?
The Insurgency. You know of the Insurgency. You're the one who told me about them.
Sure.
Yeah. And so Google them. They do a lot of songs. We're talking about socially conscious songs, and they do a lot of raising money. It says here, sent me an email, awareness for charitable causes that help people in need, environmental organizations, protecting our planet, activist organizations seeking to create awareness, et cetera, et cetera. And their influence is The Clash, The White Stripes, Neil Young. So check them out, The Insurgency. And so hey to Sherry, Greg, Leslie, and Hans.
Well, we want to give some shout-outs. Give one out to the band that my wife and I saw last night, which were Genie and the Dreams.
Yes, with the one and only Pazman.
Mark Pazman. God, that guy gets just better guitar work.
He's great.
All the time.
He's really good.
He does.
Yeah.
And we sat with WCSX's Steve Costan and his lovely wife.
Used to be on WRIS.
Well, we all work for the same company.
We're all in the same big building.
And we just rotate around. We might all be back here on WRIF.
Well,
rocking.
We're still here.
Yeah, right. Hey, one of the things, talking about nuke plants, so Detroit, well, what is it now? It's not Detroit Edison. It is DTE. Right, DTE,
yeah.
Right. And they're not happy with Fermi 2. They want to get rolling with Fermi 3.
Oh, yeah, let's not do good. That. That's that. Let's just get on that.
People always say,
God,
whatever happened with Fermi 1? Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
We almost lost Detroit.
Yeah, and it's been proven that these things are leaking.
Yeah, so they put a big cap on Fermi 1 because there was almost a nuclear meltdown. And there, if you a good book, We Almost Lost Detroit, was that by John Hersey? And a song by Gil Scott-Heron called We Almost Lost Detroit?
There was...
The late Gil Scott-Heron?
Yeah, they did some kind of honoring of him at the Grammys tonight. Yeah,
well, that's good. For somebody who didn't watch it, you know...
Because I'm on Facebook and people, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things, of course, what I always say, they have no idea how they're going to get rid of this nuclear waste. Right now, it's all piling up on the shores of Lake Erie. And on the, I forgot the one over on Lake Michigan. There's Bessie Davis or Davis Bessie in Ohio that's had all these problems.
Yeah.
And undeterred, they want to keep on going. One of the things that's going to happen is there that the ratepayers, that's you and me, are going to have to pick up the cost of anything, you know, any overruns. But opponents of this planned nuclear reactor in Monroe are asking regulators to fully analyze some frightening local health statistics before signing off on a new plant.
Oh, like cancer rates?
Yeah, exactly. Like they're going to build Fermi 3 on the same 1,250-acre site. But those opposed to its construction say that increased cancer rates that correspond with the start of Fermi 2 reactor could be should be studied before a new plant gets the low gets the green light. As part of the public comment process for Fermi 3, Joseph Mangano, executive director of Radiation and Public Health Project, called for further investigation into Monroe County statistics, including infant death rates, low birth weights, infant death rates, and mortality rates for cancer incidence rates, all of which are going up. Of 19 indicators, the Monroe County rate change before and after Fermi 2 began operating exceed the state or nation for all 19. That's fairly frightening. And I wonder, too, about the residents there. I mean, if you start talking to them about home values, I mean, they have to be very defensive.
You're already nervous to begin with.
Well, yeah. I mean, they can't say, yeah, it's really driving our home prices down, or it would probably drive them down all the more. But you would think that homeowner associations, I mean, they should talk about decommissioning this. I mean, they cannot figure out where to put this waste.
They need to start a big old organization.
They do. Well, there is.
Make your signs.
Don't waste Michigan.
Yeah, and we've talked to some of these folks.
These people have been fighting the Fermis for 30 years.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. Man. Hey, I want to give a shout-out to Brian, and it's spelled B-R-I-O-N. From Ann Arbor, who said he's been listening to this show for years. So shout out to you, Brian. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
And you know, we haven't heard from our friends from overseas in a long time.
Well, they're listening.
Finland, Singapore, where
China,
else? Tokyo, or, Mexico City.
South Korea.
Yeah.
There's more.
There's more.
Yeah.
There's more. Canada.
Australia.
Tasmania.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Hey, what are we doing? We got to go.
Yes, we do. Couple of good interviews coming up with you, Peter Werby.
Yeah, coming up, we're going to talk first about one of those subjects near and dear to my heart. Remind me. This is about Iran. Yeah,
about Iran. Yeah,
yeah. And this
and Israel and
this begin is Israel going to attack Iran? And this begins with the question of what? How are Israeli music fans intervening on the decision of whether Israel is going to attack Iran?
Okay, and we want to thank Sarah for taking care of our phones tonight, getting our podcast ready for tomorrow. It'll be available, or today, it'll be available in 11 hours.
Say goodnight, Julie.
Good night, Julie.
That's terrible.
I know.
All right.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, is war with Iran on the agenda? You certainly hear a lot of saber-rattling going on, don't you? Iran, this dangerous threat to the Middle East, this dangerous threat to the world, maybe nuclear-armed, at least that's what we hear. They seem to be pretty sure of it in Israel. Israeli fans of Madonna have begged the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, to hold off an Iran attack to after May 29th because that's when the Queen of Pop is going to be in Israel for a concert. So, like, you know, May 30th is all right with them. The consequences could be grand, to be sure. Joining me to talk about this, not about the Madonna concert, is Gareth Porter. We've had him on the broadcast before. He's an incredible observer of events having to do with U.S. national security policy. He's an investigative journalist and historian, and he's joining us from his office in Washington, D.C. Gareth Porter, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thanks very much for having me again, Peter.
Well, I'm sort of introducing it in a humorous way, but it's not very funny. And
it, no, I love that story. I think it is very significant. It tells us something about the situation.
Well, does it tell us it's a done deal?
No, not by any means. I think everybody should be thinking about this war as by no means inevitable. I think that it's preventable. Certainly it's preventable by the United States, and that's really an issue I think that everyone needs to focus on.
Well, you just wrote a piece called A Dangerous Game on Iran. What games usually, political, geopolitical games usually have to do with a lot of, diplomatic maneuvering. What's going on here?
Well, the dangerous game that I think the title, which I didn't assign to the piece, but it's fine, what that referred to is the maneuvering that President Obama himself seems to be doing around the issues having to do with Israel and Iran. It's a very complicated situation politically from the point of view of the White House. And the reason is as follows. On one hand, this president is very clear that it's not in the interest of the United States to have a war with Iran at the present time and under the present circumstances, which are that there is no evidence, there's no intelligence estimate or any other indication that Iran, in fact, is trying at this moment to get a nuclear weapon. The official position of the U.S. intelligence is that it is not aware of any evidence that Iran is trying to get a nuclear weapon, that has decided to go for a nuclear weapon. So the president clearly understands that the United States does not have any interest in a war with Iran under these circumstances, and it doesn't want Israel to attack Iran under these circumstances. So Obama has been taking what I would call careful, I would say almost tepid steps in the direction of trying to signal Israel that this is not acceptable, that the United States is not going to accept an Israeli attack on Iran. And the most recent of these indications of Obama's determination to try to avoid that was sending the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, on a trip to Israel last month. It was the 19th and 20th of January, in which Dempsey's message to Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and the Defense Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, was essentially that if you attack Iran under the present circumstances where you're not willing to give the United States a veto over the decision, but ready to go off independently of U.S. policy to attack Iran, don't expect the United States to defend you when the Iranians retaliate. We're not going to join your war against Iran.
Well, Gareth Porter, there's an old blues song, I'm paying the cost to be the boss.
Exactly.
I mean, so it's the tail wagging the dog. I mean, why aren't we saying, hey, look, like they were talking about doing with Egypt around the prosecution of these Americans, we're sending you billions of dollars a year that probably if we put up to a popular vote would lose 95% to 5% to continue aid to Israel or Egypt or Jordan or any of these countries, given our circumstances. Why don't we just pull the chain on these folks?
Well, I think that is precisely the question that we all need to be asking. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. President Obama has not been willing to go public and say to Israel in front of the rest of the world, this is not acceptable to the United States, and if you attack Iran, there will be serious consequences for U.S.-Israel relations, including, of course, military assistance and other aspects of U.S. security cooperation, military cooperation with Israel. And there are a number of things that should be done and could be done to show U.S. displeasure, not just displeasure with Israeli policy toward Iran, but actually to prevent the United States from being directly involved in any conflict, a direct conflict between Israel and Iran. For one thing, the United States has an actual military presence, at present at least, a permanent military presence in Israel, which is not at all well known.
Well, wait. I sure don't know that.
The United States has a very sophisticated so-called X-band radar system, which was sent to Israel during the Bush administration in September 2008, and it's still there, and which would, in fact, be tracking any missile attack on Israel in the context, of course, of an Israeli attack on Iran, which is the only way you're going to get a missile attack on Israel from either Iran or its Hezbollah allies. The X-band radar would be there tracking missiles as soon as they were launched from either Iran or from southern Lebanon. And therefore, it would be, in fact, part of Israel's defense in a war against Iran.
Hmm.
And so it's an anomalous situation, to say the least, that this X-band radar is there in a situation where the United States doesn't want Israel to attack Iran, but Israel is still threatening to do that.
And if there was a war, we would quite logically be seen as participating in on the Israeli side, given what you just said. Gareth Porter is my guest, and I introduced him correctly as an investigative journalist. We're kind of talking about that side. Let's do a little bit about the other aspect that I said, Gareth Porter, as a historian. And maybe you could bring us up to speed, because we need a little background, because mostly people would say, well, tell me about the Iranians. Well, they're completely crazy. They're these, Islamist fanatics, and they want to destroy Israel, and they could attack Europe because we're going to need a missile shield that's being set up in Europe, and now they're even talking about getting these 6,000-mile capability rockets, and they could hit the U.S. So these folks are a major danger to everybody because, for one thing, to start with, they're so crazy.
Yeah. This obviously is a topic that needs to be discussed. I don't know if we have enough time to really do justice to it, but let me begin by just saying that the whole U.S. attitude toward Iran from the beginning of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was established in 1979 in a revolution against the Shah's regime, which of course had been a very close ally of the United States, the whole U.S. attitude towards Iran ever since then has been highly distorted by an official hostility by the U.S. government. And I would be even more precise than that. I would say that what we have seen over these past three decades and more with regard to U.S. attitudes, official attitudes towards Iran, is that the U.S. national security state, and in particular, I would highlight the role of the CIA in this regard, has been extremely hostile to Iran beyond anything that I think most Americans feel. I mean, I know that there's a great deal of feeling across the country that the Iranians had our hostages. They took American hostages and held them for hundreds of days. And that has left an enduring sense of grievance against Iran. But I must say that problem does not even begin to reach the level of hostility that you find historically in the CIA against Iran. And the reason for that is that it has nothing to do with the hostages, a hostage crisis of 1979-1980. It has everything to do with the U.S. encounter with Iran and its Shia allies in Lebanon, and particularly in Beirut, in 1983-84. During that critical period, when the U.S. Marines were sent there, and then there was a bombing at the Marine base, and President Reagan pulled the Marines out quite correctly, because they had stumbled into a civil war in Lebanon, and they were making themselves targets by coming down on one side. But after the withdrawal of the U.S. Marines, there continued to be a covert war going on between the CIA and the Shia and other opponents of Israel and of Israeli Christian allies in Lebanon and of the United States, because we were still working with the Israelis and their Christian allies. And so a lot of bad things were happening on both sides during that period. And one of the things that happened was that the U.S. Embassy was blown up. There was an explosion at the U.S. Embassy. And if I remember correctly, 12 U.S. CIA personnel were killed in the bombing, including the station chief and three senior CIA officials in the in the embassy, U.S. embassy in Beirut. And in addition to that, later on, the next station chief, the CIA station chief in Beirut, was taken prisoner by Shia allies of the Iranians and tortured to death. So, long story short, the CIA has never forgiven Iran, and I think that there's a mentality of definitely getting back at Iran. There has been ever since in certain parts of the CIA and other national security officials who have worked with the CIA on this issue. So I think that that is a real important part of the history of U.S.-Iran relations. Now, the Iranians, of course, have their own grievances, to say the least, not the least of which people should understand is the shooting down of a civilian airliner in 1988, which was going off on a normal commercial flight from Iran and was shot down by the U.S. Navy, a U.S. Navy destroyer warship in the Persian Gulf, and killed all the human beings on board, including, all the passengers and all the crew. The person who was responsible for the decision to shoot down the airliner was then decorated as a hero by the U.S. military. That did not go down well, to say the least, with the Iranian people.
And there were hundreds of civilians lost.
284, as I recall, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, everything. Let me just a little editorial aside here, which may be inappropriate on a public affairs program. Leave it to my guests. But let me say this. This is all critical information that Gareth Porter is giving us. And if it's making your head spin a little like it is, it's because of the nature, the complexity of the situation. It could all be solved in the most simple way, and that would be for the U.S. to get the hell out of there. Instead of spending billions of dollars on these different regimes, whether it's Israel or Jordan or Iraq or whatever, and we would open the libraries in Troy and put the cops back on the beat in Ferndale and use the money there, everybody would be a lot happier, I think, both here and there. All right. End of editorial.
Well,
comment.
As you can imagine, I don't have any gripe with what you've just said. I think that's the direction the United States needs to go.
But here we are. Let me ask this. Is there a danger? I mean, you said that so far, and I've read your material often online, that there is no substantial evidence that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. If I was them, I certainly would be and tend to think that they are because, as we know, and I may have stolen this from you, Gareth Porter, that is, if you don't have weapons of mass destruction like Iraq did not, and Bush and them knew that, you get invaded. If you are totally crazy like the people in North Korea and threaten to drown the U.S. in a lake of fire and have the wherewithal to do it, they say, hey, buddy, can we make a deal? So,
Well, you're right. You're right about the logic, strategic logic of the situation. But let me go back one step here and just fill in one more detail.
Sure.
An important detail about what I was talking about with regard to the hostility of the U.S. national security state, the U.S. national security institutions toward Iran, going back all the way to 1983-84. One of the major attacks on Iran that has been consistent ever since the early 1990s, and I know everyone is aware of this, is that Iran is the world's leading a state sponsor of terrorism. And there are at least two major cases of bombings that the Iranians have been responsible for, have been held responsible for, have been accused of carrying out or being behind the
the terror bombing in Buenos Aires of 1994 and the bombing of a U.S. Air Force installation in Saudi Arabia in 1996. I've done extensive investigations on both of those bombings, and I can tell you that there is not a shred of evidence that Iran was behind either one of those bombings. But let me go back to the origin of this idea of Iran as a terror, as a state sponsor of terror. I think it goes back again to Lebanon, where Shia allies of the United States were held responsible for the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. That, I think, is what first caught the imagination and fired up the imagination of the U.S. national security state. But it should not be forgotten. Well, I mean, it can't be forgotten because hardly anybody knows about this. But if you read a book called Veil by Bob Woodward, published quite a while ago, about the Reagan administration and its covert operations, you find that, in fact, Reagan's CIA director, Bill William Casey, was responsible for having worked with essentially hired Saudi intelligence to carry out a terror bombing in Beirut aimed at killing a leading Shia cleric who was close to Hezbollah. And the result of this terror bombing was that the intended target got off, was not killed, but some 100 people, roughly 100 people, civilians were killed, and hundreds were wounded.
Including parts of his family.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. So the fact is that the United States was responsible, made the decision to sponsor a terrorist attack in Beirut. It's well known among those people who follow the CIA's covert operations very closely, not widely known outside that very narrow sphere. So before people feel sort of self-righteous about allies of Iran carrying out terrorism in Beirut, it should be understood that the United States itself was a state sponsor of terror in Beirut, causing the death and disfigurement and wounding of hundreds and hundreds of civilians.
Well, Gareth Porter, this is all important information. I don't think one thing you've completely addressed, though, and that is, given all this, I mean, it sounds like spy versus spy from Mad Magazine, except
yeah.
with catastrophic human consequences, but the United States, and this this is Barack Obama putting this forth now, continuing the Bush administration's plans, putting a missile shield in Europe in case, I remember at the end why I said the popular perception of Iran is essentially, make a long story short, they're crazy. So
yeah.
they may want to, nuke Amsterdam or Warsaw. And worse, if they develop this 6,000-mile range missile, they might all of a sudden decide, let's take out Detroit here or, New York
yeah.
or Washington.
So let me go back to the question that you posed, which is a very important one, about the rationality or irrationality of the Iranian leadership. I think it's important to understand that the people who have been in charge of Iran's military and national security policies for the past two decades are people who were associated with President Hashemi Rafsanjani. He was the president after Ayatollah Khomeini died and was president in the late 80s and early 1990s. He was then replaced by President Khatami, Mohammad Khatami, in 1997, who was elected president to succeed him. But Rafsanjani is well known on the part of those who follow Iranian politics closely for wanting very badly to reach an agreement with the United States to essentially end the hostility between the two countries and to have in-depth economic cooperation in particular. He was very intent on trying to get very positive economic relations with the United States, and it was Rafsanjani in 1995 who tried to get the Clinton administration at that point to agree to support the Conoco Oil taking a major investment share in Iranian offshore oil, which was a new field opening up that the Iranians deliberately wanted to give to Conoco Oil in order to make a political gesture to the United States in order to try to get a real diplomatic political dialogue going. And, of course, at that point, the Clinton administration, under the influence of the Israeli lobby, which had achieved extremely powerful position in regard to U.S. Congress in particular, was essentially forced say no to the Conoco deal, to brush it aside, and not only that, but then to, for the first time, essentially rule out any U.S. economic relations with Iran for the first time. And so that was a big turning point. So,
well, let me interrupt you just here because I'm looking at the clock and we're getting towards the end of it. I guess that the, you know, because this is huge and
yeah,
the history, all the tangled relationships. We need about 3 hours, and I'm rudely interrupting you.
Well,
let me
rush to the real point,
okay,
Peter.
Good.
I'm glad that you've prompted me. My point, first of all, is that these people who have actually been basically the same faces who have run the national security policy of Iran since the early 1990s are still there. They're still extremely rational. They still really want to make a deal with the United States. And the only problem is that they have repeatedly run into hostility on the part of U.S. administrations. I won't go into detail about that. I'll just leave that general point. With regard to the atomic bomb, the nuclear weapon issue, there is a tangled skein of lies and misrepresentations about the Iranian nuclear program, which it would in fact take a long time to disentangle. I have followed the reports of the IAEA from 2003 on very carefully, and I can tell you that there were a number of serious questions the IAEA was asking from 2003 through 2005 or 2007, let's say, which caused a lot of suspicion. But in late 2007, early 2008, the Iranians, who were offered a deal by Mohammad El-Baradei, the director general of IAEA, to take the Iran file off the hot burner, the hot stove, and put it in a cooler place if the Iranians were able to provide information that settled all of these suspicious questions that had been raised. And the Iranians said yes, and they did so. They provided information which cleared up a whole series of issues. There's no time to go into the details. But
in fact, we have about 30 seconds. So.
But if you look at the 2008 IAEA report, you find that the Iranians satisfied the IAEA's officials that their suspicions were not warranted. And the only thing left was the idea of these so-called alleged studies, a purported secret nuclear weapons program, 2001 to 2003. What I've shown in my work is that those documents were Israeli frauds. They were fabricated by the Israelis. And El-Baradei says in his memoirs, well, he doesn't talk about these documents. He talks about other Israeli documents, which came later, which he points out that the experts had serious questions about. He never accepted the authenticity of those Israeli documents, and I think that's something that people need to understand.
Well, thank you so much. And like I said earlier, I used the phrase spinning your head. I mean, careful now, because if we start seeing a grim president with flags in back of him, surrounded by military men, and on the nightly news, all these ex-generals beginning with maps and pointers, don't be stampeded. That's what happened last time. We need people like Gareth Porter. I think, tell me quickly, can we go to ipsnorthamerica.net and look for your name there? And
ipsnews.net does have an archive of my, yeah, that's right. North America would be the best place to get the archive.
Okay.
Archive. You're one step ahead of me, Peter.
All right, Gareth Porter, you're a wonderful resource. Thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you remember a few weeks ago on the broadcast, I had a writer for The Nation magazine, David Bacon, and we were talking about immigration from Mexico and how NAFTA and so many other social and political elements had created virtual pipeline between North Carolina slaughterhouses and Veracruz, Mexico. And we mostly talked about the political and economic and social drives that created this situation and the effect they had both on North Carolina and people there and also in Mexico itself. But these, as we only talked very little at the end, these are human beings, and there's a brother and sisterhood that connects us all. And yet sometimes borders get in the way of that, and it becomes us and them, they as the invaders, the illegals, and what have you. But there's a wonderful book that has just appeared, and it puts a human face on the people that are here without authorization. It's called Living Illegal. Illegal is in quote marks, and I want to talk about that right off the top. The subtitle is The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration, and the co-authors are Marie Friedman Marquardt, Timothy J. Stagenga, Philip J. Williams, and Manuel A. Vasquez. And Marie Friedman Marquardt is our guest. We're reaching her in her office in Atlanta, Georgia. She's a scholar in residence at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Marie Friedman Marquardt, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
You know, I think right off the bat, people are going to wonder why the quote marks around illegal and why this sort of stilted word unauthorized. I mean, the people that are here in violation of U.S. immigration laws are illegal. And yet you see bumper stickers, no person is illegal and what have you, but technically they are. Why does language matter here?
That's a very good question. We use the term illegal in the title because it is the term that we hear most often in sort of everyday discourse. But the term itself does have problems, and one of the things that we bring out very early in the book is the problems with this term. Unauthorized immigrants actually committed an offense equivalent to a misdemeanor when they came into the United States without authorization or when they overstayed their visas. So this is an offense akin to speeding. In fact, we know that unauthorized immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born, and they're often more often victims of crimes than perpetrators. We use the term unauthorized, even though it is clunky and cumbersome, because it's a more accurate term to describe the condition of these immigrants in the U.S. They are not authorized to work inside the United States.
You think I'm doing a disservice? I often use the phrase illegal immigrants, and that is what is the common parlance. I'm more than willing, and I think you've already given me a reason to change. Do you think I'm doing a disservice to the whole situation by continuing the use of the word illegal?
Well, in fact, many of the kind of most many young activists, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk about a group of activists that we call the Dreamers. These are young adults who were reared in the United States but came here young. Currently, they're working very hard to try and change the parlance because for them, to be called illegal suggests that their entire there's something about their personhood, about who they are, that is illegal, rather than that, in this case, their parents made the decision under certain circumstances to either come into the United States without authorization or to overstay a visa.
So, actually, there is a common perception that, first and foremost, that the unauthorized immigrants are job stealers, and secondly, that they have a propensity towards criminality, something you've just said is not the case. But also, and I want to get to the human face because we're now just talking about social statistics, that they are job stealers, and yet, I'm from reading your book, Living Illegal, in quotes, that's not even the widespread perception, is it?
That unauthorized immigrants are stealing jobs?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think many people do share that concern. And what we know, I mean, I think where this is coming out so clearly right now is in the part of the country where I am, where statewide legislation is being passed.
In Georgia.
In Georgia and Alabama, right? This legislation that is working very hard to promote what's called attrition through enforcement, that is to make it as difficult as possible for unauthorized immigrants to live in these states. And immediately after the passage of these laws, for example, in Georgia in the spring, the laws passed in April, by May, the associations of farm owners, Georgia farm owners, are reporting a shortage of 11,800 workers. Even though Georgia has a 10% unemployment rate, we are not finding native-born workers to fill these positions. And what we know about the unauthorized immigrant population is that they come to the United States to work because work is available. When work is not available, unauthorized immigrants don't come to the United States. And they work in sectors of the economy in which we have not had a significant enough number of native-born people to fill the work.
Well, what I was getting at was you have an accompanying sheet with your book, Living Illegal, and it says that 72% of whites and 73% of African Americans believe that immigrants come to the U.S. to take jobs that Americans don't want.
Right, and so, this was actually, we were looking at a specific community, one of the most kind of contentious communities, counties in the United States around immigration. And even in this community, even in this county, we did telephone surveys and focus groups, and we found that quite to the contrary of what we assume, many reasonable people who are living side by side with immigrants recognize that they're taking jobs that Americans don't want or that Americans might try out and are not willing to do because of the amount of work that's required.
The book is Living Illegal. It's from the New Press. You can go to thenewpress.org. There'll be a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Living Illegal, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. And we're talking with one of the co-authors, Marie Friedman Marquardt. And I can see how this could get away from me. We could just, you know, go all social statistics, all political concerns. Talk about the human face. What did you and your three co-authors set out to do, and what's been accomplished in Living Illegal?
Well, one of the real misconceptions about unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. today is that they're sort of transient newcomers, that unauthorized immigrants have not settled in our communities. In fact, what we found when we were doing research on Latino immigration more broadly, and a majority of Latino immigrants in the region of the country where we are unauthorized, was that these unauthorized immigrants have really put down roots in our communities. Their children are in the schools and doing well. The parents are involved. One of the places we spend a lot of time doing research is inside churches. Unauthorized immigrants and other immigrants, are revitalizing churches in the U.S., in this part of the country, and around the United States. So what we really found was stories of people who have worked hard and who have established themselves fairly well. Another statistic that links to some very real stories is that of unauthorized immigrants who've been in the United States for 10 years or longer, 47% own their own homes. So again, we have people in our neighborhoods who are embedded in our communities. And to assume that our communities would be better if they were to be removed is simply the wrong assumption.
You know, I know two Canadians, two Brits, and I did know until his death an Italian who died in his late 80s who were here illegally, the Italian immigrant had been here for something like 70 years without ever. And yet they were able to, certainly the Canadians easily fit in, but the Brits too. And there obviously is a racial component to it. Is that, do you see that in Living Illegal?
Yes. So one thing I think that's important to point out is that about half of unauthorized immigrants who are here currently are here because they overstayed a visa. So not because they crossed in at an unauthorized, you know, at a point, not at a checkpoint between them, you know, on the border between the United States and Mexico, but rather because they overstayed maybe a visitor visa or a work-based visa. But what we hear the most about, of course, are unauthorized Latino and Asian immigrants. And I think that one of the places where we really see the component of ethnicity coming into play is, again, these local communities and states that are passing stringent anti-immigrant legislation tend to also be the ones that have experienced the most rapid demographic change and diversification of their populations. So we talk about a community in Georgia that the white population of this county increased over the period from 1980 to 2006, but whites as a proportion of the population decreased from, I think, 94% to 60%. In the meantime, we had a growing African-American, Latino, and Asian population. And, of course, there's a history of racial tension into which all of this enters, and that has a really important role to play.
In Living Illegal, the Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration, you have a very interesting photograph on the cover and with a strange border that borders the photograph. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes. Yeah. So the photograph is, again, a young woman who's a dreamer. And that is, she's a young woman who was brought here to the United States as a child, grew up here, went to high school here, and upon completing high school, is hoping for the passage of a piece of legislation called the DREAM Act that would allow for her, if she attends college for 2 years or enters the military for 2 years, to adjust her status. In the photograph, she was actually detained in a protest at the Capitol, in a protest where she was hoping to be able to get the DREAM Act passed. And we put the photograph because she's dressed in a graduation gown, and many of the dreamers do, they wear graduation gowns when they make public appearances and public statements, again, to kind of call to mind the opportunities that they long for, that they don't have the opportunity to achieve. And we put the photograph on the cover, and particularly in that frame, because, again, one of the most just really devastating pieces of this story is the story of these young adults whose parents made significant sacrifices to offer them better opportunities. And what those parents longed for was to have a photograph just like that, minus the police officer handcuffing her, you know, on their mantelpiece. And those families have worked so hard to be able to offer opportunities. And these young dreamers really find themselves at a point where they're stuck. It will be very difficult for them to return to their country of origin. Most of them have never been since they left as very young children. Most of them may speak Spanish, but they certainly don't read and write it at a college level. But now also they're finding it extraordinarily difficult to stay and continue on here. They have to kind of go into the shadows. And this is a tragedy for our nation. I don't think it's only a tragedy for these kids. I think that what it's doing is it's keeping us from having the opportunity to embrace these very, very promising young people and give them the opportunity to contribute fully to our political life and to our economic life in the United States.
I suspect you had direct interaction with a number of these people. I mean, you have, a number of these cases are recounted in your book, Living Illegal, Illegal in quotes. What was the motivation on your part to begin with? I mean, how did... Was this, you know, just academic research, or did you have, you know, personal interaction with people? I mean, why this book? I mean, what's your personal involvement, if you will?
Yeah, that's a good question. We, the four of us, two of us are political scientists, and two of us are sociologists of religion, and we actually went into doing this research with a lot of very academic questions about what we call transnationalism, connections between host and home communities, questions about inter-ethnic engagement. But the kind of research that we do, as we sometimes call it field-based research, is research in which we spend a lot of time sort of on the ground, getting to know families and communities, visiting workplaces, visiting churches and other places of worship. And over the years, together collectively, we have dozens of years of experience doing research in these communities. Of course, we get to know personally many of the families that we end up talking about in the book. And we found that while our initial intention was to answer some sort of lofty academic questions, in many ways, our hearts were sort of tugged to address very specifically unauthorized immigration, particularly because many of us are asked to give talks, you know, in our local communities or around the country, and we find that there's so much misinformation on this issue. And people of goodwill, people of very goodwill who have very good intentions, who want the best for this nation, simply don't have the information they need to make well-informed decisions about this in their communities.
When you had face-to-face conversations, how were you received? I mean, I was thinking if somebody came to and said, we're doing a study of white middle-aged men in suburbs. I mean, they study me. I'd go, what? Because, I mean, as you know, I mean, the whole the connection between, say, anthropologists and people living in pre-technological communities is always has a lot of weird aspects to it. Were you that much of an other or that much of a stranger to the people you were speaking to? And how did they react when you said you wanted to hear their story?
You know, people were very willing to tell us their stories. Their stories about crossing the border, which are often very traumatic stories. Their stories of struggling here in the United States. People were very open and willing. And we found that again and again. I think one of the reasons that was the case is because we were trying to do research in places that already had sort of been carved out in local communities as safe spaces. And again, one of the reasons that we went to churches was because in this region of the country, churches are among few spaces in which unauthorized immigrants feel very safe and comfortable to practice their religion the way that they want to, and also to get to know their neighbors. And in this case, when we were doing research in churches, many of them would have a Spanish language worship service and an English language worship service, for example. And so they were already sort of getting to know and talking to people who they might not have identified as exactly like them. But they also, we recognize very quickly how much we share in common. And I think that's one of the things, again, that we try to bring out in the book.
How so?
Many of the native-born in these places where we did research found that once they got to know unauthorized immigrant families that were living in their neighborhoods, that were going to their children were going to the same schools, or they were worshiping in the same church. Once they got to know them, they were really struck by the fact that many of the misconceptions they had were dissolved by conversation with these immigrants about the decision they made to come to the United States, about their own priorities and values. And we found that when we interviewed the native-born, we found that many of them really were so pleasantly surprised and amazed by how much they shared in common, you know, values of family, hard work, concern for their neighbor, wanting to get involved in their local communities, that these were actually values that they shared with their unauthorized immigrant neighbors.
The book is Living Illegal, Illegal in Quotes, the subtitle, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. Four writers took this on. One of them, the co-author, is my guest, Marie Friedman Marquardt. And you're listening to The Peter Werby Show. You can check out the book at thenewpress.org or my website. We'll have a link, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. I was thinking about past waves of immigration, and probably no one, none of our ancestors ever wanted to leave, or were real pleased about leaving, because, you know, home is home. And people, even if they've been here three and four generations, still feel an affinity to, you know, to Italy or, you know, wherever else they may have come from. And oftentimes they came, like the Irish, because of famine, other people from Eastern Europe during World War I because of the horrendous war that occurred. And these folks from Latin America particularly were in many ways, it was economic drivers, but they're what they had previously in Latin American countries, in Mexico and in Central America, really collapsed the communal structures that had done them so well for so many generations. So the negative portrayal, as I was saying earlier, can they say, well, all right, let's go get some jobs. I mean, they had things worked out well. Most people would still be in Mexico, don't you think?
Yes. Now, certainly the parents, you know, the folks our age who made the decision to migrate, and there's no doubt that they would have preferred to stay home. But what's happened in the past, really, and this is very much linked to economic globalization, it's happening worldwide, is that as nations like Mexico and El Salvador and Guatemala and Brazil enter into the sort of global economy, open up to foreign investment and to markets, local economies, small-scale agricultural communities, for example, are really changed in ways that they will never be able to return to that. So for, I think, a really striking example of this, I've done a lot of research in a community in Mexico, about an hour from Mexico City, a very small town you call a rancho. And most of the adult working-age people from this small town live and work in Atlanta now. This is largely because the economic base in this community is, you know, doesn't exist. There are very few opportunities to work to earn enough money. So people work in Atlanta, live and work in Atlanta. They send some of the money they earn home. Of course, they invest some of it in Atlanta as well. But after September 11, 2001, there was a family that I had gotten to know. Of course, this is many years ago now, but there's a family I had gotten to know well. And I remember that I asked, you know, as with the rest of us, are you afraid? You know, and this, the woman who had become a friend of mine said, of course I'm afraid. And, you know, we thought about, we'd love to be able to return home. We'd love to be able to go back. But the entire community depends on us, and depends on us in two ways. Not only because we're sending money back regularly to, you know, to pay the bills for, say, my parents and, you know, our other relatives that are still there, but also because any jobs being created in those communities are being created by migrants. So, for example, many people living in Atlanta are building second homes in their home communities. So in building those homes, they're creating construction jobs. So it's a very complicated system that has been created and that cannot be undone.
Well, you just mentioned in passing, I can't remember, inter-ethnic communication. I don't know if the communication was the word, but how's that affected? I mean, how do we stop thinking of people that are here unauthorized as illegals, job stealers, crime-prone folks? How does that be overcome, either on an individual basis or on a community basis?
Yeah, and I've found, you know, over the years doing work in this area, that really the place where that begins to be overcome is in the real human face-to-face encounter, the opportunity to get to know our neighbors. So unauthorized immigrants, again, they are our neighbors in most of our communities. It would take very little effort throughout the United States to find a neighbor, someone who is living among you, working among you, who is unauthorized. And you might be surprised by who is living unauthorized in the U.S. And once people, again, just this kind of creating a relationship of trust and being able to talk about this, I think is the very initial building block. It's not politically expedient. I wish I could give you a very quick, simple, expedient answer, but I do believe that that's really where the transformation begins to occur.
And is it occurring? I mean, there seems to be a slowdown, is there not, of immigration into the United States because there's not as much work as there used to be? So the kind of hysteria that went on, you don't see these armed vigilantes any longer going to the Arizona border. So I think we've at least climbed down off the edge, the edge of the building or whatever, this situation.
Right. There has been a very significant slowdown since the beginning of the recession in the United States. We've seen a very significant slowing. Migration from Central America decreased by two-thirds in the second half of the decade from 2000 to 2010 than in the first half. Right now, we know that migration between Mexico and the United States is basically zero. We have a zero net inflow. We have basically as many people leaving as coming. I think oftentimes we assume that border security is still the primary issue surrounding unauthorized immigration. Really, the issue we face now is, what will we do about integrating or not integrating, 10.8 million people who've lived here for a while, who are well established, and who are, again, willing and able to participate fully in the life of the nation?
Can this be said in 60 seconds? That's what we have left. What do we do? I mean, a lot of people still don't want to reward people that, even if it's a minor violation of law, don't want to reward people that are here unauthorized or, quote, illegal. And I've used up about 20 seconds of your answer. 40-second answer is, what do we do about this, quote, problem?
I think the very first thing that we do is we give relief to this 2 million people who were brought here as children, the Dreamers, give them the opportunity. They, again, if the concern is rewarding people who made decisions to come here unauthorized, these folks don't fall into that category. They are ready, willing, and they deserve an opportunity to have the chance to adjust their status to become legal residents. That's number one. That's absolutely the first thing to do. The second thing is many reasonable legislators have created comprehensive reform programs that would, again, not reward, would in fact build, you know, have penalties built in, have fines and other things, but give a line for unauthorized immigrants to get into. We often believe they're here unauthorized because they didn't get into the line that was available to them, but in fact, for the overwhelming majority, there is no line. If there were, there is no doubt that they would be stepping into it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is Living, Living Illegal, Illegal in Quotes, The Human Face of Unauthorized Immigration. One of the co-authors, Marie Friedman Marquardt, has been my guest. And also Timothy J. Stagenga, Philip J. Williams, and Manuel A. Vasquez are authors as well. It's published by The New Press. You can go to thenewpress.org. There'll be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Rumors spreading around, tonight take the time. Fight the sack outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that whole mile on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.